Okay, so this is January 3rd, 2024. We're in Washington, D.C., in Larry Cohn's apartment, and we are blessed to be sitting here with Larry Cohn and with Jeff Reckenbach, and this will be both an interview of Larry and a dialogue between Larry and Jeff. They were elected, Larry as president of CWA in 2005, Jeff as secretary treasurer, and have been brothers together in building CWA during a period of many challenges.
Yeah. And 40 years.
Yeah. And 40 years. So I want to start, Larry, just very briefly, since I know you don't like to talk about yourself, just very briefly, tell us when you were born, where you were born, what community you were born in.
Right. So North Philadelphia, which does make a difference, and grew up in 1949, and grew up in a house owned by my great-grandmother, who was an Irish immigrant, Mary Frances, and my mother, who was, I'm not going into all these stories, but adopted, and my father, and my grandmother, and my mother's stepbrother. And so five adults and me, with one bathroom, but, you know, I would call it middle class, as a row house, so middle income, because they all worked. And very much, you know, my great-grandmother had been a radical. She could call herself an anarchist. She's not like exactly an Emma Goldman type, although she liked her. But, and she was old when I was born, right? So, you know, she died when I was about six. But it was her house. And then it became my parents' house because her daughter died before she did. And so, you know, it's an unusual story because it's five adults and one kid. So my mother eventually, you know, we're not doing this story, but my mother's stepbrother and his wife had two kids. They both died and they got adopted by my parents. So, but I was the only biological kid. And that was complicated. We're not getting into it. Wasn't that happy, that whole thing. It wouldn't have been happy in any case. But you know, there's a neighborhood where, you know, it was a neighborhood. So everybody's jammed in, but in these row houses. But, you know, that's where your friends were, played all kinds of sports. You know, I've sort of lived for that. Jeff was much better than me, by the way. I played everything and was great at nothing. He was great at baseball and decent at other things. But that's, you know, that's what my kid life was about, being outside and playing ball of some sort, depending on the season, and a lot of friends.
And what were the demographics? I know you talked a lot about.
Well, they changed a lot.
Growing up in North Philadelphia,
yeah,
in a row house had a big impact on you.
Yeah, well, Philadelphia had a big impact on me, good and bad. And again, to breeze through this part, you know, so the beginning was, you know, you're a kid and you're fine. The demographics were, you know, initially white working class, but eventually more black knit than white, but, you know, mixed. And, you know, my sort of organizing life as a teenager began with, you know, police brutality, and even now it's emotional to me, fighting Rizzo, who was the police commissioner, and organizing against that as a white kid. And so, anyway, enough about that.
No, actually, I know it's emotional, but yeah. This is new to me. Is it new to you, Jeff?
No.
Could one of you just briefly tell us?
Yeah, well, by the time I'm in high school, there's a movement, a civil rights movement, but even in high school, and again, we're just going to hit the highlights, but after graduating high school, still being involved in that stuff, there's a demonstration that fall. This is the highlights of what Rizzo was like. He's the police commissioner. Most importantly, he ends up leading the Democratic Party, the mayor, Tate, and this had been a reformed party in the 40s, loved Rizzo. And so so Rizzo built a political career out of being a racist cop. And so he was named police commissioner, and then in 1972, I'm jumping ahead, gets elected mayor for two terms. And he shaped my whole political consciousness in a negative way. There's positives, obviously, but in a negative way. And so in 1968, after I graduated high school, at a demonstration at the Board of Education with 3,000 kids, more black than white, he gets out of his car. He heard about the demonstration. It was totally peaceful. He brings 100 new cops on a bus, two buses, brand new. They're rookie cops. And as they get out of the bus, he says, get their black asses. And anyway, beat the shit out of us and killed a girl. So that's where we start.
So your political consciousness came more from that than from the anti-war movement of that
period?
Yeah,
we brought them together. So, and by the way, the end of the story is good. In 1970, he's been mayor 8 years. He tries to change the city charter so he can keep running. And this was a violent electoral referendum situation. And I live in a different neighborhood in North Philadelphia with my two kids and wife who worked at the library down the street. And the same racism. And it was a mostly white working class neighbor. You know, again, another row house. And people were afraid to vote. We won, though. And in my neighborhood, I spent the whole day at the voting place because people were afraid to vote. And it was violent, the voting. So that's enough about all that. But yeah, the war, it wasn't just there, but in a lot of cities, there was a confluence of fighting racism and the war. But, you know, for me, it started. I was arrested dozens of times, by the way, in this period. In my life, you know, too many times to count, more than 50. But never for anything except, you know, what I would call doing the right thing. That's not the way the police saw it. But yeah, it bled into, you know, things like organizing against the draft because I saw it as racist and, you know, kids who went to college got a deferment. So my father, who we briefly can talk about him for a minute, 7 years in the Army in World War II, went with me to the draft board and said, I fought in World War II. I'd never fight in this war. And I turned in my draft card, you know, at 18. And that's 5 years in prison. And was organizing. And we shut the draft board down. Eventually, all five, that's mobilization. We did tactics off all the members. I don't remember if there were three or five. They're all volunteers. They all resigned. That draft board was shut. Now, you know, that's obviously symbolic because the draft didn't go away and the induction center was still there. But, you know, that's they came together.
Just to clarify, when you said 5 years in prison.
That's what you faced for. I got charged with a conspiracy to resist the draft.
Did you get sent to prison?
No. The Supreme Court, in a bunch of cases, which I didn't even know about till recently. I didn't pay attention to any of this at the time. The Supreme Court, in a bunch of cases, said that the draft boards were operating as basically prosecutors. And that they weren't that. Anyway, they threw out a whole series of things, not just that. So, you know, the draft board made decisions like, and I was a resister, not conscientious objector, but they decided all those things. And but you know, you probably remember the Vietnam Moratorium Committee.
Yes.
So, at age, probably 20 by that time, I was a co-leader of that with a guy named John Braxton, and we had, he came from more of a Quaker background. And so their view was, you know, it was more symbolic and your own kind of, I call it testimony. So, you know, so he, I don't remember his exact thing, but so people would chain the draft board shut, but themselves or with one other person. And my thing from the beginning was, no, we're not doing that. We'll empty the high school out and they won't get in the door. And I never got arrested. And I got arrested a lot, but not in that. So every time they met, once a month, they're volunteers. We had, you know, 200 kids and they couldn't get in and got away with that mostly. And even then, the notion of conversion, we set up a table and we said, we need a drug center in this building. You know, it's small. Draft board is tiny. We need a drug center here, not a draft board. That's what this community needs. And so that notion of conversion was there. But anyway, they came together, and I have a poster I didn't bring out. May 5th, 1970, which is a Friday. You know, I was privileged, so by then I'm 20, to lead a demonstration where we shut every high school down. And they marched, five lines of march, to Independence Hall. And at 12 noon, we had 100,000 people there.
This is in 1970.
May 5th.
And you were 20.
And I was on racism, fighting Rizzo. And again, an anecdote, the head of the civil disobedience squad, George Fensel, who knew me well, he spied on me constantly, came to me that day and said, Larry, I want you to know. And he, you know, his whole thing was he'd befriend people like me. And you have to imagine kids 19, 20 running this stuff. You know, people don't realize that's what it was. He comes to me and says, the boss wanted me to line those five lines of march with cops with billy clubs. And, you know, when he got out of his car that day, a year and a half before that, these rookie cops pull out their billy clubs. They didn't use guns and beat everybody. And as I said, a girl smashed her head on the pavement and died, black girl. But you know, they beat everybody. They didn't beat everybody. There were 3,500 people there, but they beat a lot of people. I didn't really get beaten, but...
we're now talking about 69 or 70.
I went back to 68. But back to 70, May 5th, a Friday, at 12 noon, 100,000 people on Independence Hall, more than half high school kids. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported the next day 10% attendance.
So this was...
So you talk about mass activity and strikes and and what we can do. And we had set ahead... no elected officials. They all wanted to speak when they saw 100,000 people show up. And I made the decision, well, there's one city council guy, his last name happened to be Cohen, he wasn't related to me at all, elected at large. And he had stayed with us all the way fighting Rizzo. And again, remember that the referendum is in 1970, a few months after that, where we win, despite the kind of violence in my neighborhood. I mean, it's a different neighborhood, but you know, working class neighborhood where I lived then. That chapter has a happy ending in that he didn't change the charter. He was, and the final ending is, you know, last year, 2 years ago, his, you know, gigantic statue in front of City Hall came down.
Just to clarify a couple things.
Yeah. So that's my roots. And then I went to work in the public sector for 6 years, and that's what led to the...
Okay,
the job organizing.
We'll get to that in just a second. In 1970, May 5th, when you did that in Philadelphia, that's when the big national demonstration was here in Washington, D.C.?
No, that was not the same time.
But you called it the moratorium
in
Philly?
No, that was the year before it was a moratorium. Then there was the Vietnam mobilization. That's different.
And that's what you did, you were telling us about in
Philadelphia. The moratorium is where Braxton and I were the co-chairs at age like 19.
Here in
Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Only in Philadelphia.
Okay.
But that was a national thing that, you know, it was more mainstream than what I would. I never joined any organization except the ones we built.
Okay.
Because to this day, I don't want to get into again the details of this. It's not emotional, but it's just upbeat. I have the sense that you build a popular movement and you fill it up with the people that are in the movement. You don't have it filled up ahead of time. And so even NAM, which, you know, your mother-in-law was a leader of, which
and
I
my
did,
ex-husband.
What's that?
My ex-husband.
Well, but also your ex-mother. Healy was a leader of NAM, right?
Yeah, but Richard Healy was a leader of NAM.
Okay, but I was always fascinated by her.
Yes.
You know, we're not getting into her history. You could do that without me. To me, she had a fascinating history. And also, you know, I didn't know her except minimally, but her relationship with you, I thought, was amazing. So,
Yes.
And living, you know, helping build the house and living there and all that. But
what was 1970 then? So we had 1968 was...
70 was the Kent State.
Yeah, for context, the day before,
yeah.
Four students at Kent State were murdered by the Ohio National Guard.
Yeah, it was a couple days before. Was it the
4th? The day before.
Then I'm wrong. It's May 7th, yeah. Not May 5th.
It was the 4th.
Because it's a Friday.
Because I'd been there that weekend demonstrating at Kent State.
Uh-huh.
And I was in high school. And so I you know, we went up there for the weekend, just camped out, all demonstrations. They burned down the National Guard barracks, or the ROTC barracks, rather,
yeah.
On campus, which we to this day believe the ROTC did it, because it was a shitty barracks. And you know, gave them an excuse to get a new barracks, but they blamed it all on us, on the demonstrators.
Well, there we go. That's a link we didn't know we had.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, that triggered, and we had built this massive organization. Obviously, you don't strike every high school in Philadelphia because of Kent State or Jackson State. It's a big deal to us. It's right. All black, and they, you know, literally shot out the windows and dormitories and killed kids. Mm-hmm. In some ways, worse than Kent State.
Right.
Not worse, but different. Yeah, so we were prepared for that kind of strike activity.
Okay. That clarified
it.
So
no other city
you.
Had that kind of 100,000 people at 12 noon and shut down the high schools.
I just want to clarify for this, that was Jeff Reckenbach who was jumping in, so now we know his voice.
Yes, and our lives are linked,
forward.
And now we have another link there.
Right.
But to me, the racism came first, and again, building popular grassroots, broad, not sectarian, meaning not deep, but broad. That's a key thing to me. So. And for my whole life, and in the last 10 years, my friends in Argentina, which you're not going to want to get into, but I learned from them, they had, you know, decades of fighting fascism and using those strategies. and the book on Populist Reason, which was written by a famous political scientist, whatever he was, academic in Argentina, you know, I only read in a little book group here 5 years ago, and I said, hey, this is exactly what we believed in, because we reject, as they, in Argentina, they have had national power. They just lost it to fascism again. But with that theory, that it's not communism, it's not socialism, it's not our own, you know, and nothing wrong with this, Leninist type organization led from the top down. It's from the bottom up, and we'll live or die with it. It doesn't always work out.
Okay, let's go back. Just a couple more questions about your family.
Yeah.
What did your father do?
So he did many things. Started out as a baker, 7 years in the army. Stayed in after the war. Ended up an officer. And then, you know, a bunch of jobs. It's not going to be relevant.
Okay.
And my mother worked, in some ways more relevant. She had been adopted, so she committed herself to kids who had no families. And... she worked in a child care agency, at the end being like the head of what she called networking. But this is with no certifications. So it was to build a whole network around kids who had no families, similar to like what boys clubs might do.
And just what elementary school, what high school did you go to?
Now how's that relevant? But
I don't know.
It's
it
not
might
relevant.
Be. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I could go into all that. It's not going to matter.
I just want the names.
Yeah.
You don't have to give any more detail.
Yeah. K-8 school in that neighborhood in Philadelphia. And then my family moved eventually at Cheltenham High School.
And after you graduated from high school, you stayed in the Philly area? Did you
go? Yeah, I worked on 2 freighters in the engine room. I was, for a lot of reasons, Norwegian freighters. And right after I graduated, and came back and forth. It was 2 different ships. But, you know, that was a year where, you know, Europe was on fire. And I was in a number of those cities when, you know, students and workers, like in the port of Marseille, the port was shut down mostly by workers in that case. And, you know, our ship was not unloaded. I could go on and on about that, but we'll skip it.
But I do remember that you played some kind of musical instrument.
Oh, on the ship. I was depressed initially. I was telling Jeff earlier. You know, seasick for a week and you know, that was a period where I'm at the bottom of the barrel, literally, working in the engine room as an oiler, which, you know, some of it was a Jack London fantasy thing of adventure. And the ship was, it started out in, it was not in Philly. I had to go to New York to get on the ship. That it was a Mediterranean, line, Norwegian owned, but Norwegian officers. I was sick and depressed, and I worked in the engine room. It's not like, oh, you're seasick, you don't have to work. No, you know. So the engine room was really, in a different way, violent place. And the chief engineer was literally an ex-Nazi officer. And the ship was old. I wasn't clinically depressed, but that's how I learned to play the harmonica. For whatever reason, I brought a harmonica with me. And I would sleep on the top deck. Later, there was like a world agreement about the minimum number of square feet workers on a ship would get. Well, this was after. So the sleeping quarters that I had were impossible to me. Other people got used to it. So I would sleep on the top. And I figured out how to bend notes. And that's all you really need to learn. And then there were times where I would literally, not a lot, but, basically busking with the harmonica somewhere in the world and getting money.
Well,
playing the blues, because if you can bend notes and if you have the right kind of mentality, you can play the blues and even be white.
Sounds fun. Okay, so after the freighter, you came back to Philly?
I never left Philly, yeah. I mean,
okay.
I didn't have any. Yeah.
Right. And you never went to college?
No, I did go to college in fits and starts, eventually graduated college. And that's part of my New Jersey story, because that was Rutgers.
Okay.
And even got a master's degree.
Do you want to tell us about
that?
Okay.
There's nothing.
I want to ask one of the
I worked full-time the whole time, basically, and, initially shit jobs and then not so shit. But that's what got me. State Hospital, the Fort Dix Stockade, which was a state program, and that's the roots of the State Workers Organizing Committee
We're just about to jump into that one last question. Larry, do you consider yourself Jewish?
Yeah, in some ways. It's a multi-ethnic family, but yeah, in many ways. My father was Jewish.
And what does that mean to you? And what kind of Jewish background?
I don't want to go into all that. I mean, it's not, what good is that going to be here?
I think it says something about values, or it may not.
Well, for you and me, it might, and a few other people, but not in general. For me, some part of the later in life, the adopting the prophetic tradition kind of notion, not necessarily a theological position. And my family, my mother was raised Quaker. It's a complicated family in that way, which... So, it means something. It means a fair amount to me, not in an organized way.
Jeff, do you have any other questions before we jump
into... No, let's get into the New Jersey State Workers. I think that's...
Or do you want me to keep asking and you
go ahead.
Have the dialogue?
No, you're doing great.
Start talking about the New Jersey State Workers campaign.
Yes, it was in CWA, for years. And I had like 6 years working in the public sector. I got fired a few times, but again, we can skip that.
Public sector means New Jersey State.
New Jersey and Philadelphia. It was back and forth. So the part of Philadelphia that I lived in then, now we're in the mid-70s. It was around the Delaware River. So one side of the bridge is Philadelphia, the other side is New Jersey. So I lived in Philadelphia, but worked in New Jersey.
For the state?
It was a bunch of public sector jobs, yeah. Ultimately the state. It was mental health and corrections, although the corrections stuff I did was more... It was in the stockade at Fort Dix. They didn't call it. We did call it that, but it was a military prison, but the state had a program in there.
And did you take
at that time, by the way, it was ironic because I'm you know, technically under indictment, and, you know, they don't pay any attention. No, I mean, I didn't broadcast that anywhere. And I also got fired there, but that was part of the roots of the State Workers Organizing Committee. So I believed at that point that in that period, that, you know, public workers and not just manufacturing workers, you know, needed to organize. I got $2 an hour in the state hospital, which was shit pay even then. And you know, it's a semi-violent job also, because I was in the adolescent unit. The kids were violent. And I was only a few years older than them, and they looked at it that way. But anyway, I did believe, you know, from those roots in union organizing. And, you know, my family believed in that, not necessarily the organizing, but supportive. And so for me and many others, so the State Workers Organizing Committee was basically a lot of people, you know, like Jeff in Ohio at the phone company, or Seth Rosenholz, be similar. Seth was more in a sectarian, right?
Yeah.
You know, like DSOC or something.
No, he was in NAM.
Okay, well,
I remember
sectarian is not the right word compared to the groups I had. I had run-ins with LaRouche, like, constantly. He himself used Philadelphia as a recruiting area.
Lyndon LaRouche.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I hated sectarianism, and even the NAM thing, which I didn't hate. I liked. I wouldn't join because of this theory that we organize together, and then we'll figure out how to build it deeper.
NAM is New American Movement.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, a lot of my people I knew did join that, but you know, but I'm talking about what was called Weatherman. RIM 2, which is Revolutionary Youth Movement 2, they were all around. I actually stood in front of an ROTC building and blocked them from setting it on fire, and got a letter from the whatever he was, colonel, who ran it, and in the Philadelphia Bulletin, and I, like, hated that. But I was not, I told them, I said, you'll come in this building over my dead body. I was there alone. But then I had called ahead, and the Bulletin sent a reporter. So the combination of me, who they knew, I knew every one of them. And the reporter, they had, you know, buckets of gasoline and were ready to, you know, semi-Molotov cocktail, throw it through the, very easy to set buildings on fire.
This was probably the Weatherman?
No, this was an ad hoc group of people ready to,
and when
was going
this?
On all over the country then. 1970, that would have been? 71, I don't know.
70, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, I did not like, I was against what I call sectarianism.
And just to clarify again.
So the State Workers Organizing Committee, let's come back to that.
You went into public jobs because you believed.
No, because I needed a job and I liked the jobs. That was the only reason. Secondarily, I believed everybody should organize a union.
And where did your union values come from?
Oh, those neighborhoods, fellow union people. I love to, like I do now, interview. I call it interview. I don't say anything about myself, but I could tell you, even now, like in Western Maryland, where, you know, a different type of working class, but the stories of everybody, and they never asked me a single question.
Okay, go on. So continue with.
So anyway, a lot of the roots of SWOC, which we called it deliberately. So in the 30s, you had Steelworkers Organizing Committee. So deliberately, we called this State Workers Organizing Committee. And so Trenton was the bridge, literally, to the Fairless, the biggest or one of the biggest steel plants in the country. U.S. Steel, Fairless Works, and Trenton was a manufacturing city on the railroad bridge. If you take the train, Trenton makes the world tapes. Well, there's not, it's all shut down, thanks to the TPP and things before it. Not the TPP, NAFTA, and the things before that. But you know, we were plugged in enough to see that, you know, number one, the pay in all these jobs was horrible. A lot of the work was hard. But to me, I loved that work. It was not about, you know, I'm going to go into a factory. A lot of people did go into factories. I had lots of friends who in part went in. They needed a job, but they also wanted to organize.
What did you love about the work?
Well, because, you know, I believed that, you know, that the change was possible, and that, so even in an adolescent unit, a lot of the reasons those kids were in there, and that was like being in prison, literally, was because of the environment in the United States, broadly speaking. And the stock is, and by the way, we organized patients and their families to shut down involuntary shock treatment. I got fired for that. We had we sat down, we didn't really sit down, but we refused to work. And until they eliminated shock treatment, that failed. But then we started demonstrating, this goes back to the draft board tactic, at the psychiatrist's homes.
Larry, I think this says a lot about you, so I'm just going to press.
Yeah.
Tell, when your answer to why you loved it was because
the
you
kids
thought...
and that we could change mental health in America.
It was more the big picture and not...
No, they're not any different.
And the individuals as well, helping the kids?
It starts from the kids. I had to work with them every day. I knew all their names and spent a lot of time with them beside work. And their parents. And, you know, I'm only a few years older, remember. These are about like 17, 18-year-olds, like 20, 21. So, and they treated me that way, including the first day trying to beat the shit out of me. Two of them jumped me. So, you know, they were totally rebellious. But, you know, in that environment, and, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest had come out. We were well aware of that electric shock treatment. We weren't the only ones fighting that. But the mobilization tactic we took, number one, we started a newspaper called The Lowlifes, written by the kids, and distributed it and organized the parents and went to so in the draft board story, we went to every one of their houses and where they worked, depending on where they worked, with demonstrating against what they were doing. Not so much against them, the members, they were mostly workers. You know, they weren't workers, but, you know, postmaster, that kind of thing. One guy in the motel, another hardware store. So,
is this where you developed and continued your organizing tactics?
Yeah, well, you're learning them, and you're also reading about other people doing similar things. But the idea is that you figure out creative resistance, and at one point, and even CWA, we called it creative persistent resistance, CPR. And, you know, to us, psychiatrists were the root of the problem, and that wasn't just them, but this notion of involuntary shock treatment, which meant that without any permission, including the parents, kids would be shocked till they passed out and put on Thorazine because they really didn't care about the kids. They cared about controlling their behavior.
Right.
And one kid who I worked with jumped out the window and killed himself, faced with that kind of situation. And, you know, he had a lot of problems, but he was not violent. A lot of them were, but he was not violent. And that helped spark this. But we went to their houses and demonstrated, and eventually I got fired. But eventually, after I was gone, the shock treatment was dropped. In the stockade at Fort Dix, which was the state program there, it was called an education program, you know, we organized the inmates, and then the guards had no idea what we were doing. And there were riots eventually, and again got fired. But State Workers Organizing Committee grew out of a lot of people doing things like that, but then linking it to the shit pay and a very high inflation. And we had slogans like 5% won't pay the rent. You had 14% inflation and 5% pay increases.
So how did you build the State Workers Organizing Committee and then the decision to connect with CWA? And Jeff, throw things in as you want.
I'll try to make this brief. So,
and we're now
so we had a lot of
1980?
The early 80s now, in terms of the organized SWAT. And, not the 80s. This is the 70s, sorry.
This is the
early 70s.
And is this before?
1981, we win elections with two other unions on the ballot, the state neutral, just to go to the end of this. But AFSCME and AFT, SEIU was not involved. That was just a mistake. Affiliating two associations and us building from the bottom and winning giant representation elections for 40,000 people. And by then affiliated with CWA for a bunch of reasons and some resources, not compared to the other two, from CWA and winning those, we won all four. For, you know, about 38,000 people. But that comes out, and we still called it SWAC. And then after we win, you know, in the CWA world, with you know, 8 local unions are formed, and that's when I end up on the staff, et cetera. Probably a mistake. I should have stayed in one of the locals. But.
No, it wasn't a mistake. New Jersey passed.
But that took you 10 years, just that you're interested in stuff. That it was about 10 years of organizing until we went to the bargaining table. All the good organizing that I did, I shouldn't say all the good, but most of it was, which people always don't pay attention to, it's never quitting. And even in the organizing basics, my favorite page, I wrote a lot of this. I could dig out the exact words. How long? As long as it takes. How long? As long as the committee will, this is stage 2 of the committee, as long as the committee will be organizing inside, we'll be supporting them outside. No time limits. And that came out of not just my own experience, but my belief that as long as people on the inside, this is inside outside, will organize and carry on the organizing activity, the least we could do is stick with them.
We meaning the union.
By that time, the union. But, you know, in any case, the people in the organizing will stick with it. Those organized and support on the outside, it's not a hardship.
So talk about the committee of the, I forget the number.
Yeah, so we build it to 1,000. Did you find the pin?
Yeah, I can.
Where is it?
Oh, you covered it up.
Yeah, this one. So this didn't exist till it was CWA, but this notion of a committee of 1,000, we were very serious about.
Can you read the pin out loud?
Yeah, I can see it. every worker or member, committee of 1,000, CWA, this is 86. This was already a formal thing by 81, but that's a nice looking pin, which, as you can tell, part of my thing in CWA was nice looking pins. There's a whole series of them here.
Why?
Because pins like this people would wear all the time. And pins like this, even though this was 1987,
yes.
I don't want to be blamed for that pin. They're sort of ugly, and they're not going to wear them for long. But there's a whole bunch of pins. This was a Quebec local that left CWA eventually, but this is their pin, which I loved. And this is the movement pointing at the individual. So it looks like a human, but that's actually the arrow is key. We have other pins with arrows. Anyway, I have a whole box of these kinds of pins.
Okay, I think you've explained why you like pins.
But I like enameled pins, not that people... So this is one near the end of my time, CWA mobilization pin. There's a lot of those. And even now, Claude has a pin he gave me when I met with him in the summer.
Claude Cummings, the new CWA president.
This is not your typical kind of union pin. So if you got that pin, you would wear it day after day, not necessarily every day. That notion of design a pin with people that they like and that they'll wear.
And that
so the Sprint Employees Network, which you probably were supportive of, meaning your work every day, that pin is beautiful. That's in here. I have to find it. And that's a beautiful pin. You could at least one person replace their earring with the pin.
Okay, we get it. It's a way to build solidarity.
But beauty.
And beauty.
Yeah. So another theme for me, which we probably won't get into, is the relationship, you can see it around this apartment, not that, but of art and, but also music and art and even these pins and design, as opposed, and things like this long before we had memes that would sort of bring people together and tell a story. And obviously that's an old thing, but that was something that I embraced.
Okay, I think we were on the committee
so
of 1,000.
It took 10 years. Mm-hmm. But at our best, what we learned, not initially, is charting. And in the early days of CWA organizing, when I came there, we had these giant wall charts. And there was no organizing committee, whether it was 20 people or, U.S. Airways 10,000, where every workplace wasn't charted out with every name.
Can you describe charting? And when we're off...
Yeah, I didn't keep one of those charts, sadly.
Well, I will tell you then. I went through Danny Fatanti's room to prepare it to give to Texas what's the University of Texas at Arlington's archives. I think there were, that he had saved at least 100 charts.
Oh, there you go. So you'll take a picture of that.
The question was from his wife, Barbara, how many of these will they want? I said, enough so that people understand that this is the essence of an organizer.
Yeah, so obviously, you know.
So describe charting.
He's somebody at a national level I hired. We also,
Danny Fatanti.
Yeah, but it's a funny story for him because by the mid-80s, early 80s, we had these clunky computers. And very early, what do we call that type of software? Not membership, but database software. But clunky. These things were not laptops. They were clunky. And I was big on, you know, every full-time organizer in CWA is going to use one of these. He was anti-tech. And we would have huge fights over it. And for him, it was the wall chart. And, you know, I was a proselytizer and designed the initial wall chart. So it's not like I hated wall charts, but they're not efficient. You're not going to just drag, you know, especially on larger things we did, like the AT&T wireless organizer. You're not going to chart out tens of thousands of people.
Can you explain charting?
But to go back to New Jersey, so charting and lists. So I'm a fanatic about lists of every person. So, you know, eventually we're talking about 38,000 people. And within a 6-month period, we had to collect and file, something like 12,000, more than 30% of 38,000. So we had a cushion, not a big cushion in that case, but you only had 6 months. They were timed out in New Jersey had no law initially when I was working there. So by this time they have a bargaining law, and that's what led to these elections all over the country in the states that had public sector laws. So anyway, before that, there were two associations. And as I said, part of the story of the other unions was the affiliation instead of the grassroots bottom up. If I was ideological about anything personally, it was bottom up, not top down. Now, at some point, I began to believe in both. But that's like, you know, I'm already like, you know, I probably have like teenage kids by then. So I hated top down. Literally absolutely believed in bottom up. And, you know, leaders would come. Shop stewards is what I believed in, you know. Organizing committee members, committee of 1,000. They weren't stewards, but they were organizers. So the key to being committee of 1,000 or CWA organizing committee, and that's the organizing basics, really the second CWA organizing manual, is the committee. And the key to being on a committee is that you will keep track of 10 to 20 workers. And why? Because you're not going to be able to really interface with more than 20. But together, our number one activity in stage one, which is contacts, is mapping. And mapping leads to charting. And charting is where we have these big charts, and you could look at the number that's on there, because I don't remember. But let's assume 50 names on a chart going down, and then smaller columns going across. And then you would label each column what it was, what you were charting. You know, did they do X? Did they do Y? But a whole series of activities. And you would rate them. And we only used 1 to 3 deliberately. You know, all the unions, to the extent that they did anything, was 1 to 5. And to me, that was bullshit, because 1 to 3 was subjective behavior. So,
what is 1? What is 2? What is 3?
So 1 means they actively supported the union. You could see it in their behavior. So I was a behaviorist. I learned to be a behaviorist working, you know, very young in a state hospital. I didn't know what behaviorism was. I learned what B.F. Skinner was. And I loved B.F. Skinner. I'm not, again, the ideological left thought Skinnerism was bullshit, right? Because it came from a different place. But to me, you know, teach people positive reinforcement and give it to them and get rid of shock treatment, get rid of Thorazine, not totally get rid of all drugs necessarily, but positive reinforcement. That's how Haley is so great.
Haley's your dog.
Yeah, and I would argue that's why my kids are great. It was all, you know, there was some negative, but virtually none.
So what did that? So what was 1? What was 2? What was 3?
So 1 was, it depended on the campaign, but on the chart, their behavior, so they could, let's say, at the minimum, you know, they were public about supporting the union, not just signing. We're talking now private sector, you know, not a neutral employer.
So one was support.
But active. You could see their behavior.
You were
a pin. My great-grandmother said, I'll watch your feet, not your mouth. That, to this day, that's what I believe in. I don't give a shit what people say. It's what they do. Especially, I say this to electeds all the time, including Obama, the last time I saw him when he was still president on the TPP. It's what you do. And all of you believe, particularly Axelrod and the people around him, it's the exact opposite. It's only what you say.
Okay, so that's one. So what are two?
So number one, they get rated a one if they engage in the behavior that we're doing. Number three was the people who were against, and number two was everybody else. So the point of that kind of versus the one to five was that anyone could do that rating, right? Anyone. And the whole notion of organizing basics, and you know, that became sort of ritualized in some way in my world in CWA, you know, starting in the mid-80s, and sort of enforcing that kind of this kind of approach, but it's a very bottom-up approach, even though it's a ritual of its own in some ways. But the one to three, when every other union did one to five. Oh, this one's leaning this way, and this one's leaning that way. Yeah, well, how do you know? Oh, by what they say. Really? You care about what they say? I don't give a flying fuck what they say. And that goes back to literally her and being raised that way. She said, everybody in this house, this is what I told Obama. I literally quoted her. Everybody in this house can talk, five adults and me. So she's talking to me as a five-year-old. Everybody in this house, I'll watch your feet, what you're doing. I don't care what you say. I said that to Obama the last time I saw him, one-on-one in his office. I'm no longer president of the union. I'm helping to lead the fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He gives me a 30-minute lecture about Vietnam and China and why we need the TPP. And I had to just sit and listen. You know what I'm like. I don't like doing that. And at the end, I said, I just want to quote my great-grandmother. And I still love you a lot. And, you know, as you know, we split the union. East Sterling supported Clinton, and I supported Obama. The union was split in 07. And it started at the CWA Legislative Conference where that we bring them both to speak. We're supposed to be neutral. She introduces Hillary and announces for her. And so then I introduced Obama and more than paid her back.
Who is she?
Barbara Easterling, okay. Secretary of Treasury at the time. My first Secretary of Treasury. This is the best one ever. You know, this is recorded, but I just said it. So now I said it, and I do believe it. I don't really want to be quoted saying that, but now I am. when I ran for president in 05, it was with her. She was the incumbent for God knows how long. When did she get elected? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, she'd been around a while already at that point.
Yeah, she'd been EVP. Anyway, we make an agreement, the two of us and the board, will stay neutral. The members can go the way they want. And that won't last. That's the whole way. It'll be intermittent. And in the introduction, it announces for Clinton. So, you know, I'm a pretty fast thinker. And so I decide, well, I won't just introduce him. I'm going to say to the people, well, you heard that. I happen to be... We weren't going to be talking about our opinions, but now that Barbara did, and that's fine, because I wasn't going to pick a fight with her. I support Barack. I'm pleased to introduce him, and gave a funny introduction about him, and we had a big hug, and because he had no idea that I was going to do that. And there were other unions that did endorse. Haley, you don't need to go out.
Barbara became Secretary Treasurer in 1992, which is checked.
Okay, so this is 13 years later. She didn't hate me personally, but she didn't like my leadership, and he could elaborate on that a lot better than me. She didn't want me in any of these positions, right?
Okay,
anyway, we made our own peace, and I liked her. You know, she's still alive. I could tell great stories about her, but this was not one of them.
Okay, let's go back. I think we're almost at the end of the state workers.
So the SWAT thing.
What I want to ask, and Hannah, should we give Haley that bone that'll keep her?
No, she'll be all right.
Okay.
We want to save that, so we're.
Okay, I'm going to be very cognizant of the sound quality.
You don't need to. That's my job.
No, but I want to. But stopping this so that we can make sure the sound is good. Why did you go with CWA?
We had I actually have a copy of it somewhere. But we had a flyer, and it had a caricature. Jerry Wirth was the president of AFSCME, and his brother Al, talk about nepotism, was the quote leader in New Jersey. And we don't need to get into how did he get to be that and everything else. Let's just say not about democracy. And you know, Jerry would be viewed, you know, even in that NAM circle, New American Movement, as progressive. Not to me as a worker, and not to my, you know, colleagues, brothers and sisters, as we would have said then, siblings, but we didn't say that then. AFSCME was in total, and they did organize one unit of state workers, you know, before we were not involved. SWAC existed, but anyway, it was uncontested. Al Wirth played tennis with the Democratic governor, who we hated, of New Jersey. So again, my political orientation, hate Frank Mirza, thanks to the Honorable James Tate, as he called himself, even after he was mayor. Rizzo became the leader of the Democratic Party, and I gave this lecture, literally as a lecture, to the full DNC over and over again when we fought to get superdelegates out and the party reform stuff. Literally, this is after I left as president of the union, they would have to listen, including Mayor Nutter, who was black and was the mayor in recent years of Philadelphia, about why any old blue just won't do. And I say, Mayor Nutter, this is 500 people are in the room. You know this story full well, that Mayor Tate, you know, literally anointed Rizzo as police commissioner, who was beating the shit out of people, mostly black, and then paved the way for him to take over leadership of the Democratic Party with this demonstration in his past, get their black asses and beat the shit out of us.
Let's go back to why.
And so
you didn't want
AFSCME. Now we're in New Jersey, and the leader of AFSCME, Al Wirth, whose brother is the president and viewed as a liberal, you know, would have supported McGovern in 72, so did CWA, but virtually no unions did. They supported Nixon or nobody. Wirth was the darling of the left. This is why I don't like, you know, the left per se. And I don't dislike them, but I don't like them. So there's a neutral zone. Because it's all symbolic, top-down, bullshit. And so Al Wirth literally played tennis with the governor. We're getting shit pay and living through, you know, the day-to-day work experiences that the activists at least lived through, right? And the shit pay for everybody. We organized. And so the idea that AFSCME was going to come in top-down, you know, figure out in their own way, in a very different organizing style, how to file these petitions. So we were the ones who filed first. They did intervene. You only need 10%. You need 30% to trigger.
Was the positive about CWA?
The positive about CWA was that the CWA leadership in the district they didn't embrace this. If we could get into that, I don't really want to. I don't want to record that. But they didn't really embrace this style. But they embraced, for lots of reasons. Morty Barr and Jan Pierce. Morty was the elected district VP and was, you know, wonderful supporter. But, you know, a lot of this was not their world either. This is New York, you know, New Jersey's small at that point. New York is the dominant thing. And on the telephone side, New Jersey only has the operators. And they were amazing. They could bring tears to my eyes, the individual operators who supported us.
AT&T in New Jersey.
Well, it was New Jersey Bell, yeah. And nobody called it AT&T.
No, I mean, the long lines were in
Yeah,
New
that's
Jersey,
a whole other story, but that was small. But that's where Clara Allen was the Jersey director. She's a whole other story and her connection to this.
Okay, and back to Jan Pierce. He was the assistant to Morty Barr, who eventually became
president. And then that day, he was elected vice president, right? The same day.
So Morty was supportive, you're saying?
Yeah, mostly not involved. And, you know, we were raucous. I mean, it wouldn't have been easy for those. They were totally supportive, but we were totally independent. And even Watts, who was definitely an ally of what we were doing,
he was
a whole thing going on about it in New Jersey, and how do we, what if we win? we're going to have 38,000 of these people, and we were organized a lot more by then. So while we built SWAC, and then when we were organizing not state workers, other people.
Meaning county and municipal.
Yeah, county and some private sector people in their own independent ways.
And Watt, Glenn Watts was the president of the National Union at that point.
Right, okay. Barely new president initially in the early, well, by the time we affiliated, yeah, he was president for 5 years by then. So when I say affiliated, it was informal.
There was no affiliation agreement?
No, because we were an organizing committee. We didn't represent anyone. We had a lot of supporters organized in a structured way, but we didn't represent anyone. And that wasn't our even framework initially. It was more of in its own weird way. Anyway, I don't want to get into that. I'll get off the track here. But the main reason we came to CWA is two reasons, the positive and the negative. The negative was AFSCME. We actually had a caricature of Worf. I don't remember the the picture, but I know the headlines. They have one lobbyist. We have thousands. And I, the picture was probably us in front of the State House demonstrating. And so that was top-down unionism. And we totally rejected it. Now, after we win, there's tension in CWA about that model, even in District 1. That was not – and Watts was, you know, amazing is all I could say. Because even in that conflict with – and I'm not getting into it, but the conflict that we had politically – with Jan and Morty, Watts was, and some of that was probably Watts' own, the Jimmy Carter stuff, you know, District 1 supported Kennedy in 1980, so this is now 1981, and Glenn Watts and the union supported Carter. You could only imagine that. I mean, it was overt. Morty had events at his house. And, you know, the choice between those two, for sure, personally, I would have been totally sympathetic to that, but I'm just saying, that was in the background. But then we have this conflict about bottom up. We're bargaining this contract. We had 100 people on the first bargaining committee. By that time, I'm on the staff and I chair the committee. But the notion that you're going to have 100 people, elected people, 100 people bargain these contracts, and they were in the room together because even though there were separate bargaining units, we forced the state that we're going to be in one room or else you're going to have a circus here. But they didn't. That was not the way of CWA. Were you involved in bargaining by then?
Oh, sure.
1981?
Yeah. No, my first bargaining committee was 74.
For Ohio Bell?
For Ohio Bell.
Right. Yeah. Right. So you know what I'm talking about. Oh, plus, yeah. You had Marty Hughes. Talk about top down.
Right, exactly.
And I liked Marty Hughes. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. So, we're not getting into that this minute. But I, in the scheme of American labor at that time, I would have put him way up there, despite, you know, what eventually took him out. But so put that aside. But this idea that we're going to have 100 people, elected people, and we had fights over it.
Why was Watts wonderful?
He was very supportive of, and I think it was mostly genuine. Did you know him?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was, even though, you know, I wasn't looking to be anything, right? It was always, I get my joy, and this is true. I like leading in a certain kind of way, but I always got my joy from, you know, large numbers of people, you know, going back to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in the Rizzo thing, where we went to jail together. But you know, May 7th, now I know the right date, thanks to Jeff, of 1970, you know, you can't describe the joy of seeing 100,000 people there and no violence. And you know, Rizzo doesn't get the police to attack.
So
the joy comes from, you know,
right,
the friends.
Right, so finish the statement of...
So Watts, the bargaining when we win.
Watts was wonderful because he supported.
Well, I don't want to get into his own head, but he.
No, I just
he
want.
He consistently supported me personally.
Okay.
Even when I had some conflict, because of our notion of political action, particularly, but also the bargaining. You know what it was like. Our bargaining went on forever.
Okay, let's finish one thing. You said. The reason you chose CWA, you've given a lot of the negatives. What was the positive?
Positive was, fine, you can organize in that way. I don't remember, you know, it wasn't huge, but financial support.
And was this largely...
And traditional labor would have thought we should be eliminated. Just as 4340, CWA convention wanted to eliminate. You were a staffer by then.
4309.
Yeah, 4309, 4340 was the plan. Sorry.
4309 was the Cleveland.
Was the Cleveland commercial, clerical, you know, just a mishmash of predominantly female jobs.
And Jeff, at age 19?
Yeah, at age 19, I was elected president.
Yeah, that's unheard of in any union, let alone CWA. One of the things the two of us share is sort of way over our heads at a young age.
For sure. Yeah, I was definitely over my head.
Yeah, but we shared that, and we learned from that, and we didn't know each other at all.
But there's a certain positive about naivete. You don't know what you can't do yet. And so you try to do things that, you know, other people would look at as being, well, you know, that's just the way it is. You can't change that. And so you tackle those tasks with that innocence of not knowing that or not understanding that that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I like to think that we kept that the whole time we were in the union, some version of that.
Yeah.
You know, it got mediated, right? Because, you know, if you have certain positional power, I call it, you get certain responsibilities, whether you like them or not, right? You're manager.
Mm-hmm.
But that notion of, you know, in my case, he can speak, I'm sure he already has for himself, but, you know, literally inventing constantly with other people, though, and trying out, you know that's something I'm proud of. And still, you know, our revolution coming out, I had an argument with Bernie before I agreed to work with him at all, where I said, Bernie, this was 2 days after my term
Bernie
ended.
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, 2 days after my term ended, 101 in a shitty office next to the liquor store over on Massachusetts Avenue, Schneider's, I think it was called. Anyway, the worst office you can imagine for somebody who ends up serious candidate for president of the United States, and just the two of us. And I said to him, Bernie, I'll volunteer. I said, no, Larry, I want to pay you. You'd be an amazing top leader of this campaign. I said, Bernie, I love you dearly. I'll never work for you. But I'll volunteer 10 hours a week because I had a whole bunch of things I wanted to do, volunteer. And the volunteer idea I got totally from Jeff. Jeff had left 4 years earlier and told me at the time, listen, I'm not taking another job, but I am going to do a bunch of things and I'll always be here for you, that kind of thing. He was amazing. And I relied on him a lot, not like, you know, our successors didn't really do that at all. But, and by the way, not relying on me is one thing. His sense of CWA is, you know, I mean, I couldn't even describe it. I don't know why. I know why, because he was so active at the youngest possible age. But was the best of anybody I ever worked with. The sense of CWA, the whole of CWA.
What does that mean to you, Jeff? I'm going to stop.
Anyway, let me go back just to say this to wrap that part up. The CWA was the mix of not ask me, knowing that we would be taking on. So Watts didn't care, and Barr. And I met Watts. You know, I had to come do, quote, you know, sort of formal meetings in that period a little bit. Not a lot. More so with Barr and Clara Allen. And Morty and Clara Allen, basically didn't speak. And she was the New Jersey area director. And he's the elected vice president. Now, New Jersey at that time, you know, probably had 10,000 people in New York, mostly New York City. New England had almost nobody. So the districts in New Jersey, New York, and New England. And New York probably had 40,000. And I'm making up the numbers. It doesn't matter in this interview. But so politically, she several times ran for national office and lost while she was at the administrative level in the union and a woman. And she and I got along great. I mean, not perfectly, but great. And she didn't speak to the vice president. I mean, she would if she was sitting in a chair and he said, but not voluntarily. So, you know, this was a rocky kind of situation. But that's, you know, that's what labor is, frankly, at its best, I would say. I didn't know that then, but, you know, because I was basically a bottom-up organizer and a worker. But I learned that, you know, in fact, eventually, and now I'm on staff by this point, and I learned that whatever amount of time I was going to put into doing this work, and typically for me it was 60 or more, I'm not bragging about this, a mistake in many ways, but 60 or more hours a week, half of it was internal. that building unity, working inside, and this goes all the way through the mobilization ideas, the behavioral part of it, but working inside is a constant process. Whether in a local, whether in a shop, or an office, it's a constant process. And you may, and I use the song, we use the movie, not the movie, but whatever you call it, the video. It was before we used the term video, from the ILG. And the song in there, now I don't remember the title of the film that they made, but the song was freedom. Freedom doesn't come like a bird on the wing, doesn't come like a summer rain. You have to fight for it, work for it, day and night for it. And every generation has to do it again. And so the song is fine, but the key to me is it doesn't, unity doesn't fall. It's not ideological. You know, that notion of, you know, traditional unionism, whether it's right-wing business unionism that was rampant in the building trades that were Rizzo's allies in Philadelphia, they were his allies. They were his core. And you know, and my whole political life was fighting him and that kind of notion and racism, but not just racism, that kind of iron-fisted fascism. But they ran the unions like that, top down. And so the notion that we did all this work and that we're going to end up in AFSCME, run by Al Werf, playing tennis with the governor, and a kind of cronyism politically that, you know, was typical in unions at that time across the country. As opposed to, no, we'll make our own decisions. But, you know, District 1 in our structure could speak for New Jersey, too. Mm-hmm. But our membership in the primary, in the general election, yes. But in the primaries, our membership supported different people, particularly the guy who's Speaker of the Assembly, who was running against Florio.
Larry, I think we're about at the point where we're going to move on to your dialogue. But
okay,
before we do, there was one other question. There were many CWA leaders of your generation who were part of SWAC, and I'd love to get some names just.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, first of all, you know, a benefit of CWA, not a benefit, to the credit of Watts and Barr, when we won, we then had significant. So first of all, you got 38,000 people. I mean, there was no dues. This was one of the tension points because of the way we bargained. It was a long time until we had a collective agreement. And that first agreement was 2 years, by the way, 17% pay increases over 2 years. Nobody in the country was doing that. And it was because of the agitational model, you know, the roots of, we didn't call it that then, you know, the Committee of 1,000, which we did have, and how we confronted the state on the job. It was job action without strikes.
Who were some of the leaders who emerged?
But they said to me, you can pick, I don't remember the number, but 7 or 8 people, this is out of this feisty milieu that we were in, to be, because it's the only job title they had at the time, to be CWA reps. Well, you got to imagine the lifestyle difference of, you know, the kind of, and before that, so at a certain point, I became, you know, what they call blue voucher, left my the job, blue voucher for years in my case. You know, not years and years, but I don't remember now, 3 or 4 years. But before we win the election, I'm now CWA rep and basically just doing organizing all over New Jersey. So we organized a lot of people in the public sector mostly, although we didn't limit it to that, before, and had representation elections before the state elections. But so a lot of the people who became those initial 7, so this is Carol Gay, she'd been an activist in Camden, she's, you know, has health issues now, but hopefully it'll be okay. And she went on to be a New Jersey area director. Kathy King, who was a staffer for a long time in New Jersey. I'd have to think through all 7, but my best ally and best friend was Jim Gallagher, became the president of local 1039. So that was the other thing. We got to create these locals, more or less. I say more or less. CWA would have had, you know, 50 locals. You know that model.
Yeah.
Right? And we would have had fewer, but one of the ways we organized was by department, because it wasn't just the $2, the pay. One of the initial bargaining demands was $5,000 minimum pay for full-time work. $5,000. This is 1981. You could figure out the arithmetic of how low that pay was. And we won that demand. And by the time I left, it was $18,000 minimum pay for any full-time job. Mm-hmm.
Any other names that you want to
mention? Yeah, I'm going to mention. So Gallagher, who became... So all the initial local presidents were key leaders. And these are big locals. And they had CWA, 60% of the dues are in the local union, 40% of the national. The national has a lot of the heavy lifting, all the bargaining costs, all the arbitration costs. So the locals had huge resources. So Jim Gallagher was definitely, you know, he didn't want to go to the staff, you know. And, you know, I had my own misgivings of all that, but that was water under the bridge by the time we won the election. And he was totally amazing. My best friend, you know, he was probably Jeff's height, but 400 pounds. And barely by the end, he died of a heart attack. Dropped dead while he was local president at probably under 40. I'd have to think that through. I don't remember.
Jeff, how tall are you?
6'6".
Okay.
Yeah, so he could have been 6'4". I don't want to diminish Jeff. But 400 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
An incredible organizer. Anyway, that's a few names. I don't want to... I can think about that and send you a list if you really care about that later. But
did Hetty...
But there, you know, it goes on that list. I mean, mm-hmm. I can list names of people who, you know, are no longer active that were the key leaders. Marianne Rieger was the first president of Local 1034. She was incredible. She dropped out of a nunnery, literally. And her uncle was the Speaker of the Assembly, Joe Merlino. One of the reasons we had a rebellion about Florio. Merlino ran in the primary. And there's, you know, you could think about the top-down notion. Well, we don't care that we need Merlino. He's the Speaker of the Assembly. He's running. And his niece is one of our top 10 leaders, Marianne Rieger. No, no. We like Florio. We're endorsing Florio. That's how they endorsed Florio. There was no involvement. So ratchet ahead to 2016 when we have a referendum vote in the union to endorse Sanders, which we set up before I left. But Chris was, the thing went on for months, but nonetheless, that's how Sanders got endorsed in CWA, a referendum vote.
Right.
Anyway, with Clinton, it's, you know, the inside choice at that point.
Okay.
So we'll stop there, but there are a lot of names.
Okay.
They're black and white. So Brooks Sunkett, so the people I named were white, but Sunkett was a critical leader, Treasury Department. He was an auditor. He was not there at the beginning of SWAC, but he was there by 79 or 80. We win in 81. So he was the first president of that local. Norm Levins and Carolyn Wade. Carolyn was not the president, but she, anyway, they have a whole complicated history of 1040. 1031, which was higher ed support staff, state colleges, Abby DeMille, she was amazing. 1032, was Pete Sorenzo, that was the highway department. And in the organizing, they were Department of Transportation Organizing Committee. And they called themselves DUTOC. They were engineers. They weren't just engineers, but led by engineers. These people had a degree in engineering. This is, you know, not what American labor was about. And they were incredible. And for them, it was about fighting privatization of their work, not losing their jobs, but and about what they were. A lot of what we did, whether it was mental health or engineering, was about the work. That's why we organized the locals by the work, a little bit geographically, because North Jersey believed they were another world. That's the New York world. But mostly organized around the work, meaning department by department. That's how we charted to go back to that. Department by department.
Did you want to ask anything more about
back. I think we're ready to move
in. The leaders were amazing. They were almost all under Sorrento was the only one I remember. Oh, no, Hetty's husband, who's way older than Hetty Rosenstein. Mike Hopkins, quite an individual. Again, on recording, I'm leaving it at that. I loved him dearly. He was first president of the North Local, and he was older. And he drove a Checker. I still remember him showing up in his Checker. And at that time, you have to imagine it's the 1970s, and a crew cut with the hair sticking up, that old kind of. And he was like that, and he wore a suit. I didn't have a suit. Nobody wore a suit. Nobody thought of wearing a suit. But he was as committed as anybody, but much older.
Wonderful.
Sorrenzo, the engineer, much older. Levins, much older. but most of us, Committee of 1,000, 30, 35 years older, or 20. Black, white, men, women, split. It was quite a group.
There's a whole lot more we could ask, but think we probably should take a break and then move on. Okay, well, thanks for the conversation thus far, which brings us up to an important time in the union, which is the seismic change that came with divestiture in 1984. You're bringing in New Jersey state workers just before that or around that time was part of big shifts in the union. But what I want to have this dialogue focus on then is the components of the new strategy, I guess. Well, not new strategy because it was a Joe Byrne strategy from the early time, but how building mobilization, building organizing, building political action and bargaining. In your locals, districts, national, over the period of time. And I just want to get a timeline for each of you, just timeline, and then we'll get the stories. So Larry, you got on staff as you were organizing SWAC. You were a staff rep. Then you became New Jersey area director.
Yeah, not immediately, but
that was the next step.
I was New Jersey area director and leading the organizing in District 1.
Okay, so you were titled organizing director.
Things I was doing.
Okay, and then the next.
And then I was the assistant when Morty got elected president. Jan was vice president. For a bunch of reasons, District 1 got two assistants, which we then got rid of.
So you were assistant to Morty Barr when
no,
he was...
No, I was assistant to Jan Pierce.
Okay. And then...
Along with Larry Mancino. We were very different.
Yes, you are. And then...
Loved Larry, just for the record. So.
And then you came to headquarters as organizing director under Morty?
No. Assistant to the president in charge of organizing and mobilization, which is the word I used.
Okay. And that was what year, do you
remember?
So that remember?
Meant the
Wait,
whole...
Wait, no, we'll come back to that.
1986.
Okay,
86. But I was still leading New Jersey and living there, so I was doing multiple things.
Okay.
I didn't live here then.
Okay, and then the next was in 2005 when you were...
No.
When you were... The next was what year when you were elected?
98.
Executive Vice President. And then...
2005.
Elected president.
And Jeff's elected EVP.
And you retired.
And Jeff, before that, is elected. He can speak for himself.
Yeah. And you, and then you you resigned and retired in 2000.
I didn't resign. The term ended.
The term ended in what year?
I didn't run again.
Okay. What year?
15.
2015. Okay.
2 days later, senior advisor to Bernie Sanders. So there was no break. Stupid on my part.
Okay. And Jeff, why don't you give us just your
outline? Yeah, so I'm not as good with dates as Larry is, who has an incredible capacity for every kind of number you can imagine.
Yeah, but some of them are wrong, as you learned over the years.
Yeah, by fractions.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always in the right ballpark, whereas you know mine is a lot of guesswork. So if I go... Let me go backwards, as perhaps might be easier for me. So I retired in 2011, I chose not to run for re-election. Actually, at the time, we were trying to do some belt tightening within the union. We were trying to, you know, make some accommodations to cut our expenses. And so I suggested it would be a good time to eliminate the position of executive vice president. And I was secretary treasurer at that point, and Annie Hill was the executive vice president, and Larry was the president. I announced that I was not going to run, and then Annie announced she was going to run for secretary treasurer at that point. So 2011, I retire from CWA. 2005, I was first elected executive vice president with Larry. 2008, then I would have been elected secretary treasurer upon Barbara's retirement.
Barbara Easterling,
right. And so going back then from 2005, I was the district vice president for the Midwest region, which was Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And I was elected president or vice president of that region. Oh gosh, I'm gonna guess probably a dozen years earlier, maybe 1993, something like that, somewhere in that range. Bob Johnson had been the vice president at that point. And I had been an administrative assistant to Bob Johnson during that period of time. Bob succeeded Marty Hughes, whose name has come up a couple of times during this conversation this morning already. Marty Hughes was the district vice president. He asked me to join the CWA staff in 1981, I think. January of 81, I came on the CWA staff. And I worked for Marty for, probably 5 years, somewhere around there. Mid to late 80s is when Marty finally resigned and Bob Johnson took over. It's a remarkable string of lucky circumstances that got me to where I was. Beginning with, as Larry mentioned earlier, getting elected president of my local at age 19.
That was what year?
That was would have been 19. I should be able to do the math on that. 1972.
And that was which local?
Local 4309.
In Cleveland,
which, as I mentioned earlier, is a predominantly clerical local, service representatives, data processing, yellow pages, although not the sales reps in yellow pages, but all the administrative work behind the yellow pages and white pages, pay phones, which was where I hired in at, something completely obsolete.
Begin working for Ohio Bell.
I hired in at Ohio Bell at age 17, when in 1971, and I hired in, and first of all, it was a lucky circumstance again. I was hired in to be a lineman, which would have been a different local. They had us go out and meet our foreman, or who was going to be our foreman before we would go to training. And the foreman starts swearing at me, "I've got no use for you, you know, go back down to the employment office. I don't know why they sent you out here." And I'm thinking to myself, great, I'm going to go home and tell my parents I got fired before I even worked a day on the job. And I can hear, you know, my dad saying, "I told you you should have got a haircut before you went down there." At any rate, it turns out because I was 17, I couldn't drive a company vehicle. And so I was no use to him because I couldn't drive a truck. And so they sent me to the payphone department, which was a completely different local, and just a happy circumstance that I wound up there. I didn't have to drive a truck. I was responsible for all of the keys for each individual payphone in the city of Cleveland, which there's a separate key for every payphone. And so we had to put them together every day for phones to be collected. Anyway, I get there, and the local president approaches me, asks me to join the union. We didn't have agency shop at the time. I signed a card right away. I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood, so I knew well of, in fact, there was a Chevy plant, not a
quarter of a mile from my home. So a lot of UAW members, steel workers in the neighborhood. So I joined the union right away. He says, well, your group doesn't have a steward. Would you like to be the steward?
On day one.
I have no clue what a steward is. But I say, sure. He says, well, we're going to need some help in this group. We don't have anybody here. And there's a good chance we're going on strike in a month. Oh, okay. Sounds good to me. In fact, I graduated from high school on my first day of work at the phone company. I had to rush home. Our graduation was at 6 o'clock that night. And so I had to rush home, change my clothes, and go graduate from high school. And I saw this as a great opportunity on a personal level, because my high school girlfriend had moved to St. Louis after graduation. Her parents had transferred to St. Louis midway through our senior year of high school. And I thought, well, this is great. If we're going to go on strike, I can go visit my girlfriend. So I asked the local president. I said, look, how about if I do double picket duty the first week? He's putting together the picket schedules. And then I could take a couple days off that first weekend of the strike and go to St. Louis. He said, sure, that'd be great. In fact, we've got a couple of 24-hour offices downtown, and it's almost all women that work in those buildings. I'm going to have you go from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 o'clock the next morning.
Oh, wow.
Well, for a 17-year-old kid, no problem. Yeah, I can do that. So I did that for a week. That Saturday morning, I get up. I'm going to go on an airplane for the first time in my life. I go to see my girlfriend. She's waiting at the airport with her father. Her father's got the biggest smile I've ever seen on a guy's face in my life. They had settled the strike while I was in the air. And they take me to lunch, put me back on a plane, fly back to Cleveland.
That was it?
Never saw or heard from her again. in the days where you had to pay for long distance, and we exchanged letters, a couple of letters after that, but that was the end of that romance. Yeah. But in the meantime, everybody thinks, what a great union guy this guy is. He was there from when we left at the end of the day, and when we got there in the morning, and boy, this guy is dedicated. And I don't want to diminish my affection for the union, which really crystallized a little later on when, as Larry mentioned, CWA was the only union that endorsed McGovern.
And one of five. Yeah.
In my world, it was it. That was, the AFL-CIO didn't.
Right.
We did. That's all I needed. And I had been real active in a bunch of anti-war issues around the Cleveland area. And so, that sort of was, wow, these two progressive, ideas come together for me. So, anyway, that's where my genesis of my activity. So
I'm interested in the girlfriend. Too bad we're recording. We'll come back to it later.
Yeah.
That was the last time you talked to her?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, later we want to. I want to catch up on that.
Yeah. Okay.
Your interview with John McCurley.
Yeah.
It went up to this point, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
So we can.
But we
put all
we
that.
We have
up.
More to.
Right.
To
right.
Do,
right.
Which maybe we'll capture in this conversation.
Yeah, and I think actually with McCurley, I already talked about sort of a good part of my time as a local officer. And it, in some ways, just to piggyback on Larry's experience, it really came from this sort of ground up sort of push on things. And again, in my instance, Larry's comes from a very intellectual place. Mine came from...
Well, it's a mix.
Yeah, from just, here, this is what makes sense. So we had a number of issues that I confronted early on as a local president that had been long established practices, but I was too naive to recognize that, that this is the way things had to be. And so rallied people together, built, sort of this, without calling it mobilization, this network of people that were ready to stand up and fight back against some things that we didn't think were right. One was when you came to work on a Monday morning as a service rep, you started at 8 o'clock, your break was at 8:10 in the morning. Right. So 10 minutes after you arrived at work, you went on break.
Some people, not everybody.
Everybody, because the phones would light up at 8:30 in the morning when the office opened. And Monday was the busiest day, and so you had to take your break at 8:10. And so we've mobilized around this issue, 8:10, never again, and you know, built this big rally, and we walked off the job. Yeah, we walked off the job, and you know, we crushed that so that, you know, they had to now schedule regular breaks. So, you know, what kind of break is it? 10 minutes after you just barely hung your coat up and, you know, you're going on break. So it was that kind of thing. And there were a couple of other issues just like that. We had an advantage in Ohio with the Ohio Bell contract in that we didn't have arbitration, but we also didn't have a no-strike clause. So, you know, we could strike over grievances. And so I employed grievance strikes as a regular weapon and you know, got people mobilized ahead of that, you know, getting people geared up and recognizing that this is something we can have an impact on.
Did you inherit a steward structure, or did you have to build one? It sounds like you didn't inherit, at least at the pay.
Yeah. It was shabby, and as I said, we didn't have agency shop at the time, and so a local that had a potential membership of 2,000, we would normally hover around 1,300 to 1,400 members, and you know, 600 or 700 non-dues payers, and you literally, on a monthly basis, you had to sign up 100 people just to stay even. I mean, people were getting in and out, and so it just made sense to try and, you know, build this network from the ground up to get people to begin to connect and understand what it was about, that it wasn't just, you know, some insurance premium that they were paying. So anyway, I won't spend a lot of time with that because I did spend a lot of time talking with John McCurley about that.
CWA had a button, exactly the opposite of that. It doesn't cost, it pays. Join CWA.
Right, right.
Exactly the opposite of what you just heard.
That's right. And I refused to use those. Because we had those at the time, and you know, they said, "Oh, here, the, you know, pass these out." And I said, "Well, wait a minute. You know, people think that's all they have to do, and that isn't all they have to do. I mean, you've got to have them engaged. They got to understand what the union's about." In some ways, I think, you know, we were stronger at the time because you had to go out and talk about the union and what it meant to be a union member. And sell people on the notion of being part of something bigger, beyond just signing the card to pay your dues. You had to connect a reason with them to do it. Once we got agency shop, in many instances, we got lazy about, you know, getting people engaged.
When was that?
Agency shop, I think, came in the phone industry in the 75 contract, maybe.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, that was national. Yeah.
Well, at AT&T, it would have been national.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but all the Bells. You know,
that's what I mean. They're all owned by AT&T at that
right,
time.
Right, that's right. So I think 75 was when we got agency shop. So in that first period where I was local president, I mean, you literally had to sign people up on a regular basis. I mean, you had to have an organizing committee. You had to, you know, you had to really work at it. And the previous local leadership hadn't really done any of that. They had really gotten pretty lax about it. So that's.
So you wanted to.
I just want to highlight the grievance strike. You know, he skips over that like lots of people were doing it. This was a major reason, my opinion, not knowing him or 4309 at all, that they had a whole series. It wasn't just the grievance strike. That this was the other place beside New Jersey. You know, when I came in 86, 87, because I was still doing New Jersey. To focus more on the country, the stories, and he's gone by then, he's on the staff, but since 81, right?
Yeah.
But the roots that made it key for us, because some people said, oh, well, that's, you know, you're a huge group, you know, public sector, but the roots of mobilization that we used and wrote about, as I said, in the first manual was 4309. They had a whole series of activities, especially by then, because then you had Ryan and Rosen coming right after you.
John Ryan and Seth Rosen.
Right.
Right.
And you know, they kept that going. And at that time, it was ironic because you're on the staff and they're getting labeled like we were in New Jersey. And I don't remember before or after. as way too radical. It wasn't necessarily radical, but their behavior, we don't like it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, and it was really...
I mean, this local was almost notorious.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. No, after, when I left, my vice president was an African-American woman, Lily Bellevue Holt, and so she became president. The next election after I had left, John Ryan ran for local president against Lily and beat her. It was close. I mean, it was a close election. And Lily then took part of the local, and this was absolutely at Marty Hughes's direction, and split off the portion of the local that was predominantly African American into this 4306.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, and left the 4309 part, which was the service reps, which were really the core of our activists. I mean, they were really the ones that sort of drove all the activity we had, split the local apart, and so that became a huge fight. And John and Greg Reamer, who was the vice president of the local at the time, and George Smilnack, came to me and asked me to run against Marty at the time. I had just been appointed to staff, and I said I can't do that. I empathize with where you guys are, and I'll do what I can to help, you know, behind the scenes here, but.
And you're like 30 years old, too.
Not even. I think.
Anyway, roughly.
Yeah, yeah, late 20s.
4306?
Lily Bellevue Holt.
And what work group?
So that was the data processing folks, the Yellow Page, all the clerical Yellow Page, a lot of different, you know, clerical groups around the city of Cleveland that we had organized. We're all in 4306. The service reps and a couple of other groups were then in 4309.
The payphone people.
The payphone people went to 4306, I think. You're right. I think the payphone stayed with 4309.
And the reason Marty Hughes did this was 4306 was more black people?
He used that as a reason to do it. But
positive
his,
reason.
Yeah, his was the concern over this activist sort of mindset that had been created in this local, and when you were doing that, now you've got agency shop, and so now you've got a local of over 2,000 members, but the driving force behind it comes out of this service representative group, which is Seth Rosen, Jeremy Genovese. There's a whole crew of folks that have really, you know, sort of built up off this grievance strike process that we've been through over the years, and so it was.
That's only in Ohio and primarily in one local.
Yeah,
it's a major, major thing. People think now, you know, a lot of these tactics that we use, but particularly now in this case, 4309, you know, those are new ideas. They're not new ideas.
Yeah.
And some of them go back to the 30s and sit-down strikes.
Right.
You know, and again, a lot of the tactics that I fell into and use totally, we didn't know each other. But they're not. We did these en masse in that period, and we'll get eventually to this 2004 strike of 4 days. Nobody in the country did that, and you know we invented that, Jeff and I, and Morty went along with it. The 4 day strike of 100,000 people at AT&T in advance, telling them it's 4 days and we're coming back to disarm the anti-unionism of the company. We advertised it in advance. We'll be out 4 days. We're coming back. But we showed them that 100,000 people were ready to walk out. But the creativity that Jeff helped create in the union and that the people he's mentioning, you know, perpetuated after he went on the staff, a lot of it is rooted in the local right to strike. That nowhere else, that didn't exist anywhere else in CWA. And yeah, some of the mine workers, locals had it. And eventually used. When did that end, the local right to strike?
Between contracts.
Yeah, yes. To strike at any time on a grievance, the grievance strike.
Clarify.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that ended, it was after divestiture. And I think it probably was when SBC took us over.
Uh-huh.
Took over Ameritech, merged with Ameritech, and they already had it.
They never had the right to strike for grievance.
Right. Right. And they had Connecticut too, didn't they?
Yes.
Connecticut was in that group as well. So it was at that point that, and the quid pro quo, I guess, for that. If you, but the other part of the problem was within Ameritech itself.
Right.
Ohio was the only one that had the right to strike. The other four contracts within Ameritech, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin, all had arbitration as a result of grievances.
Right.
And did not have the right to strike. So.
Well, that is the quid pro quo, though. You do get arbitration.
Right.
And it's not like you could strike on every discipline right. or every firing even.
That's right. Yeah, and at the time, there was also, you know, getting card check recognition from
SBC. Well, 86, I was involved in that,
yeah.
negotiating the first card check with AT&T.
Yeah.
That was 86, and that was John Carroll. And, you know, I was pushing my way in to say, you know, this is organizing. And Carroll, who was wonderful to me, he was the EV, one of the three EVPs then, and he was in charge of AT&T. He literally brought me to bargain that piece and getting that one paragraph that we didn't have anywhere else in CWA. AT&T will neither help nor hinder when workers organize. And if a majority support the union, then it laid out the procedure to have an arbitrator, verify that in fact there was a majority. And as you know, for me, that's a major, going into that bargaining with AT&T, convincing Morty that that's worth fighting for. John Carroll didn't need any convincing. Now, I'm not saying Morty needed convincing, but Carroll was amazing, you know, because I was just the one who bargained it.
Okay, this is now after divestiture. So when we're talking about AT&T in 1986, we're talking about the long distance company. Still 100,000 CWA represented folks. Yes, it's the long distance company at that point.
You can.
And why was negotiating card check?
Mostly that's right.
Neutrality.
It's the long. It was card check and neutrality. Yes. Majority sign up. I never called it card check. Majority sign up and neutrality. In that negotiation, it included manufacturing, and that's huge in terms of what was going on in America, and then the horrible trade policy of Democrats as much as Republicans, and every single manufacturing plant, the biggest consumer, meaning on the corporate level in the world of telecom equipment, the lead industry in the world, the economy at that point, and we lose not only in divestiture, the separation from AT&T, the customer, but plant by plant, the work all leaves America, encouraged by our trade policy. So, but in the meantime, we did a ton of organizing. When I came, there was no organizing department. It had been for a couple of years. They created one after New Jersey. It's a whole other story. But anyway, basically, the National Union didn't do organizing, and Morty was committed to doing it. But loose in organizing and that majority sign up paved the way later for AT&T wireless organizing. But in that initial period, we organized all over Lucent and had a truce with the IBEW. Before that, they fought over every campaign and they would whine and dine. It was horrible organizing. And so, but in the Lucent world, it included engineers, engineer assistants, every single plant, and you know, amazing workers and amazing union members.
Lucent was the spin-off of the Western Electric manufacturing plants, which I think was around 2000. Was after you were president, correct?
No. What was after I'm president? I'm sorry.
The spin-off of Lucent.
You're talking about as an IPO? I don't know the year for that.
Okay, and it was around 2005, 2007. We can look it up.
Yeah, doesn't matter right this minute.
Did you finish your?
Yeah.
You were talking about.
I just went on this dialogue.
Right. But I would also add in there Vic Crowley's role down with
that's
SBC.
Later.
Right. And getting the card check down there.
I wanted to ask one thing about the militants of 4309.
Mm-hmm.
Was a majority female local?
Yes. Yes. The local was majority female. It was probably 85-15 female to male.
And what about black-white?
Black-white, it was...
They split.
Well, once they split, it was probably 85-15 white to black. But if you had the amalgamated, and they came back together, so they, the merger was undone, came back together, and that took a vote at the convention. It was a whole mishigas. But 4309, if you did it demographically by race, was probably, 60-40 almost, African-American, white
early
African-American, yeah, early 80s, yeah.
So was there, because it was majority women, mm-hmm. how did that impact, if it did, the militants?
You know, I mean, my experience in the union all along is women have been far more militant and better leaders of actions than a lot of the men have been. And part of it, I think, stemmed from the fact that there was clearly a hierarchy between the male-dominated jobs and the female-dominated jobs within that industry. So, you know, here you've got a what they would call a craftsman working outside getting paid almost twice what somebody who with a similar set of skills, intellectual skills, is doing work inside. And it's simply because those were the male jobs and these were the female jobs. And it was only until, ironically, the EEOC stepped in and signed a consent decree with AT&T that eliminated a lot of practices that literally led to this path of only men in these jobs. For example, the job that I got hired into was had the exact same pay schedule as a craftsman, except it cut off at the two-year point. So the schedule was 5 years. Mine went up to 2 years, and the notion was then that you if you wanted a craft job, you got a leg up by having worked in this inside job as pay. So it was all guys working in there. There was a clerical section, but they didn't get a leg up into a craft job by working in payphones. But I did, because I was working in this payphone job. Now, I never left the payphone department, so I didn't avail of that. I was already pretty active in the union.
The local president was full-time or not?
No. Gosh, no. Even with 1,200 members, we were all part-time. And I would probably, it was almost a 50-50, my time on the job and my time working for the union. And part of that included time where the company was paying for my time, joint conference time, where we're actually meeting with the company because they paid for that time. And that grew as, you know, as I got more active with this notion of, again, I'm calling it mobilization now, but we didn't have that word for it. As I got more active with that, probably to the point where I was maybe a day and a half working on the job, and they at that point had to accommodate and put somebody else in there. And so whenever I was in there, I was just like a bonus. You know, it was, in fact, most of the time then I would just do union stuff working on the job. And it was a different environment too. I mean, sort of acknowledged that was part of the way things went, and so they didn't really give us any grief about doing union work on the job. They gave me a phone, in fact, and that became
give you a wireline phone.
Yeah, that sort of de facto became
is that right?
Yeah, the local office.
Oh, that's amazing. Under,
yeah. So.
So talk about.
But I just want to stress that route, which we used in the 87. As part of my function with CWA mobilization, which we did call it in 87, was to use those examples and those leaders, as much more so than the ones in New Jersey, because they matched, 70% in a certain way, not exactly, but industry basis was similar to what was still 70% of the union.
Unlike New Jersey, we inherited a union.
Yeah.
You guys created one.
Yeah, and but you inherited a union that had activism at its core because...
activism, but, there was a certain amount of stagnancy within the union at that point as well. I mean, we were pretty content. It was a heavily regulated industry. You know, the employer got cost plus from the rate makers every year, and so if their costs went up in negotiations, they were able to get that back the following year out of the regulators.
And it was a monopoly until 84.
Right. Right.
And in the local, probably in monopoly until the early to mid-90s.
Yeah.
You still,
yeah.
It was AT&T where the challenges were
right.
Greatest. So how did you build the mobilization or promote the mobilization culture and strategy?
You know, some of that was getting district VPs. You couldn't get access in CWA for somebody like me. So I'm, you know, mid-30s. Yeah, barely. Yeah, mid-30s. How do you get? At that point, you know, because of the New Jersey experience with such a gigantic, diverse group of people, again, you know, at least half women, you know, black and white together, you know, consciously.
I'll get to that, but we haven't talked about that. How did there were significant black in New Jersey?
Yeah.
Majority.
No. But for a lot of us, whether we were black or white or men or women, we knew that we needed. First of all, that's what we wanted. But so the notion of you know, the activists being from an appearance as well, not appearance, but being a cross section. So in the organizing basis, the organizing committee must be a cross section of the workplace, and then that's defined. It's defined in terms of, you know, black, white, and brown, men and women, and all the job titles you just heard about in detail from Jeff. Well, you can imagine the number of job titles is at least 5,000. So you have less than 38,000 people, and probably 5,000 or more job titles. Well, you know, so it's not just the job title, but as we talked about, it was the departmental. But the notion coming out of, you know, a country trying to fight racism, not the whole country, but millions of people, you know, we weren't about to reproduce it in a brand new organization. So it was consciously at every level, including, you know, in CWA organizing. The organizing committee, the leadership, has got to reflect the workplace.
Was this a challenge throughout your 10 years of fighting racism within the union?
I mean, at some level it was, at least, you know, I can speak for the phone piece of it. It was institutionalized, you know, from the phone company. And so you had this existing construct already from the phone company where, you know, African Americans were typically on the lowest jobs, lowest paid jobs. And so, yeah, I mean, you had to build your way out of that culture. And I mean, I consciously continued to have an executive board. I always ran with my vice president was African American, my secretary treasurer was African, or treasurer was African American, my secretary was a white woman. But you know, you were aware of this. I mean, and this was still coming off early on the 60s and the civil rights movement, and in Cleveland in particular was a very polarized city.
Right.
There's a river that goes down the middle of Cleveland, and the east side is where most of the African Americans live, and the west side is almost exclusively white. It's changed now. It's different now. But there was, you know, there were all these sort of institutional constructs that were in place. And so you had to consciously reach out and, you know, get African American, particularly women in my case with the local, engaged and, you know, working on union activities. And, you know, the reality was they were fantastic. I mean, they, you know, they wouldn't take shit from anybody. And it was, you know, it was a great way to help build that union, build the local. So yeah, and that continued. And I, you know, to Glenn Watts's credit, I mean, he was aware of this as well, and consciously was making sure the districts and sectors were appointing African Americans as staff, and you know, to the dismay of some of the district vice presidents, who didn't think that was the way that they needed to go. And I can think of Marty Hughes when he was told, you know, if your next appointment of a staff has got to be an African American, he would pick the most obscure African American he could find, versus a leader, you know, who was outspoken and, you know, helping to build things. He would go and pick somebody who was, you know, fairly docile in terms of their view of organizing and the union in general, and then sort of put her on a shelf and then say, see, look, you know, I did that, but that's what I got.
Did you have the organizing by African Americans for more power? As opposed to the leaders picking?
Yeah, so I think the Minority Caucus started. Yeah, that the Minority Caucus probably had its roots right around that time.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it's so many years ago, so it's hard to get where the yin and the yang was. But there was clearly a push within the union that got built and began to create a pressure on the National Executive Board. I mean, if you look at the National Executive Board, when I came on staff, I'm trying to think now if there was a
Dina Beaumont.
Yeah, Dina would have been it, and she came.
That was an affiliation.
Right, in through a merger affiliation. So otherwise it was all white men up there, and tailing behind, I think, a large part of the rest of society, but probably in step with most of corporate America still at that point.
Let's go back to mobilizing. So how did you build, you were the director of organizing and mobilization.
Director of Organization was the title, if we want to know. Organization, not organizing.
Okay. At any rate, how did you try and build a culture of mobilization? And as I recall, 1982, there was it was not Committee of the Future, it was...
Yeah, some version of that.
Committee on the Future.
Committee on the Future?
Yeah, I think so.
I wasn't involved in that, though.
Okay.
So you have to dig that out somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay,
were you involved in it?
No. No.
Talk about mobilizing.
Yeah, so, you know, it was clear to me that the way to do that, so first of all, it was clear, if we talk about Jobs with Justice, I won't do it now. We don't need to.
Yes,
but it was clear that that the United States, you know, in the world, and partly because I worked in that engine room and what was going on, I always had some sense of the world, not just of the United States. But, you know, not in any detail, didn't speak other languages, but I knew full well, and we started Jobs with Justice in 1987, that we were at the bottom in collective bargaining coverage of every democracy in the world, the very bottom. And that American labor, including our beloved union, our union changed, but didn't even acknowledge it. Because if you went to a global union meeting, the richest unions in the world, I'm talking about money now, were all in the United States. And you still had the notion that the AFL-CIO itself, you know, at that time, put aside things like Working America and counting those numbers, which is what they do now. But now there's 7 million members who are in unions that have bargaining rights. They double it by using everybody who ever got signed up in Working America, which, you know, I don't care. But
7 million in the private sector.
No, this includes AFSCME, AFT, paying dues. Let's call it 8 million, because Jeff's right, I get in the right ballpark. I actually have that data, but I don't want to go get it. No, there's only 8 million people, almost half of which is public sector. Remember, NEA isn't in the AFL-CIO, but who paid, that their unions paid, quote, dues to, it's now 45 cents a month, to the AFL-CIO. That's all there are. And then there's the NEA, and then there's some other things, right? Like the Teamsters. I'm not saying it's the whole, but that's the AFL we're talking about. Almost half of it is public sector.
Back to the founding of Jobs with Justice.
Yeah, it was clear then that, you know, without participating in any, and one of the other things that occurred is the reformation, I call it that, in CWA of global work. And I worked with Barr on that. He didn't lead it. I mean, he did lead it in a titular way, but I did the work. And other people helped, like George. But and Eduardo Diaz.
George Cole.
Yeah, and Eduardo Diaz. But this is on the staff level. It was a staff-driven thing. It wasn't that important. The consciousness that collective bargaining was already a disaster. When I was born back in North Philadelphia, Jeff in Cleveland, we knew this. We didn't know the numbers then. Even little Larry, I knew baseball batting averages, but not these numbers. But it was 35% in the private sector. Today it's 6. That crisis was already there, and I was well aware of it. And when I had the discussions about, you know, leaving New Jersey and all the rest of it, again, a lot of it was framed in terms of, you know, this is a disaster. There's no organizing rights, and bargaining is being destroyed in this country. You know, striker replacement, that whole notion, let alone the rest of the world and how that would operate. So, so for me, the question was, having been through, I'd almost call it the torture of bargaining in New Jersey, you know, for all the new groups we organized, but particularly, you know, holding 37,000-38,000 people together and using mobilization, because that's all we knew, that's all we could do. Strike was illegal, you went to jail. We did have work stoppages, but I'm just saying, it was in my head that to do that job of organizing in the way I defined it, it had to include collective bargaining. And CWA, you know, was the last CIO union. And by the way, in Cleveland, you know, the CIO in Cleveland, he can speak for it, he grew up in it. Cleveland had the benefit of being, you know, a city with some version of equality of black. It didn't have Frank Rizzo. I'm not saying it was great either. Mm-hmm. But it didn't have Frank Rizzo.
Before that, we had Carl Stokes, the first African-American mayor of a major city.
And it's not a coincidence.
Yeah.
It was a cornerstone as much as Detroit of the CIO. And, you know,
right.
So was Akron, so was, you know, Lorraine with the steelworkers. But that, where he grew up, where Jeff grew up, no, that the CIO was an organizing-focused organization that had been basically destroyed except for its remnants. But CWA was the last CIO union. And so it was very clear, which meant the national union had a huge role in bargaining and resource-wise. You know, we didn't have a great strike fund, but we had a defense fund. And there was a notion that if there's a strike, if there's a tough bargaining thing, we're all in. And even the history of the president of the union's role in those situations, right? And the executive board on the strike. So I knew, and it was part of what, you know, my give and take was with Morty Barr and to some extent Jan Pierce on whether I would try to take this on. It had to be contract mobilization. We couldn't bargain the way we were bargaining. And that had to be in part because we're in a crisis. And even then it was at the most 20% of the private sector had dropped from 35. And then this whole time it's now, you know, plateaued at 6.5, but it's continued to drop percentage-wise, minimally now.
Describe what you mean by contract mobilization and how that.
Well,
was
the
different.
The slogan you didn't like that I used to say, even the big groups in CWA, we all focus on what goes on at the table. We could have 5 Einsteins or 5 monkeys, and the outcome is going to be mostly the same.
Keep going.
So that was part of how I would introduce. Why does mobilization matter? And then we did the first version of that.
You want to move your chair away from the cabinet?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
And again, Ohio, but 4309 in particular, but I would say broader. Lots of the leadership and definitely a Bob Johnson. And I don't, you know, when did Marty, what you said this before?
Mid to late 80s.
Yeah, so it's the same time frame. Yeah. Bob Johnson was amazing. And he and Jeff was his partner in the leading that work. District 4 was incredible for me personally. Marty Hughes absolutely believed in organizing. He was very excited about New Jersey. You know, I think I might have been the only one, but I came out there when he started to try to organize state workers, which Jeff was involved in Ohio.
Contract mobilization.
Yeah, so it's the notion that that the issues that you are going to focus on in bargaining come from and are processed with the members, including relatively obvious things like surveying. So again, if you think about mobilization, involve as many people as possible, as broad as possible, deep, so-called deep, a strike, or even more impressive, a grievance strike, because that takes more discipline, an intermittent strike, but that you start mobilization. If it's contract mobilization, there's other types, political mobilization, but contract mobilization, you know, 6 months before expiration, particularly in a larger group, and that there are mobilizers, not just stewards. So it's structure, mobilizers, one for 20 at the most, members. It's education. We start way in advance. We figure out together. It's two-way. What is the contract going to be about? All members participate in at least surveying. They're not all mobilizers. Ideally 10% are mobilizers. And that action, the third component, it's another triangle, structure, education, two-way, and then action. Action starts with wear red shirts on Thursday, right? And we started that the year before Horgan was run over and killed in Verizon, and that local then took it up as religion. But wear red on Thursday came from the first big year of CWA mobilization, which was 87. And it starts with wear red on Thursday. And, you know, we got to that with, we did a joint thing. The Boilermakers had started Inside Out, and they had a whole program around the contracts. And we did joint training, me with the leader of the Boilermakers. I was leader, I wasn't elected. I was the director of organization. We met in Kansas City where they were based, ironically, the Boilermakers, because they were doing a version of this throughout the union. And we brought people from every district, you know, 3 or 4 days, and a lot of them came away with, yeah, that's the way we want to bargain. And, you know, Morty was somewhere in between. He was great at negotiations. But he, you know, supported this idea. And so it started then.
Then meaning the first post.
87. It wasn't just about that.
The first contract was 86.
Yeah, 86 was not, there was no CWA mobilization.
Okay.
CWA mobilization was not linked to telecom bargaining.
Okay.
It was linked to a strategy for the union, no matter where you work. And again, the biggest example was the New Jersey thing, but again, 4309 was an example, in some ways in a deeper way, with these grievance strikes, and that history, and, you know, so the whole notion was to redefine bargaining, and the linkage of the mobilizers, one for 10, to the actual elected people at the table. Not two worlds. We're not just there to support them. We're there together to figure out, you know, if we're going to do meaningful bargaining, to figure out where we end up. And again, a lot of people hated that, including the structure of the union, because it meant the bargaining process, I laugh, would go on much longer. And we didn't, and, you know, if you believed in this model, some of it was belief, you know, you didn't care about that. So we didn't care when the contract expired, although we like to care about when the contract expired, so you begin way in advance of that. But strike was a tactic. We defined, and this is very confused today, including my friend, you know, Sean Fain, Sean O'Brien. He's not my friend, but I don't dislike him. I just don't know him.
Of UAW.
Yeah. You know, the strike, or Sarah, well, I don't want to get into that about CWA. So the strike is a tactic. It's an action. We have a whole series of these, which that's the way these booklets are broken down. It starts with where we're at on Thursday. The strike is not necessarily the penultimate. Most private sector workers in the United States practically have no right to strike. They'll be replaced or some other version. They don't have the power to strike. It won't make any difference. The employer will say, good, see you later. But that doesn't mean they don't have a way to build power. Mobilization, as you see in that booklet, mobilizing to build power. From day one, That's what it was about. Every member could relate to that in some way.
How important was education to mobilization?
Most of the activity. Go back to my great-grandmother. If you measured most of what people did, it was the education defined as two-way discussion. It's not one way we'll teach you a new language. It was, let's figure it out together. This is in the ideal. Let's figure it out together. So it's a different kind of unionism. And to link them, those mobilizers, we're the best organizers for new units, not just the AT&T wireless kind of organizing where we had the advantage of we're AT&T or blah blah blah. We do the same, except for retail, the same jobs. Right, customer service technician, retail is different, but all kinds of organizing. So CWA organizing was based on, you'll organize where you live. This notion of Norma Ray, the organizers flying around the country, our team, virtually eliminated it. So district-based, not DC, never was DC-based, district-based in a national team. So the trade-off was those district organizing coordinators, Seth Rosen, that was his, when he left the local initial job, but he had done organizing before, you know, because we had the advantage of, like Jeff was talking about in his own thing as a local officer, you could go off the clock and you'd still have health care, but the union would pick up your pay, right, reimburse. So from day one, for me, as this organizing director, almost, you know, except, for, again, there was a lot of receptivity to it that had its roots in CWA, but And at that time, for 5 years, I had wandered all over District 1 with big organizing drives, you know, that helped build a different culture there with Morty and Jen. They embraced that. The idea that we had to grow the union or we're going to die, you know, the way we're – and that was at 20% of the private sector. Again, we're now at 6. But in CWA, even when it was at 20 – you know, more so than almost any other national union, definitely in the private sector, because we were private and public both at that point. When I came there, represented, we know how to do both. Embraced the notion, and that's why we were the founder of Jobs with Justice, the principal founder, that, you know, we're on a death march here. All you got to do is look at the chart. That's not going to stop at 20.
End part one. Begin part two.
Mobilization. Education.
So they all start at the same time. CWA mobilization, Jobs with Justice.
My understanding of the origins of Jobs with Justice is that a first post-divestiture organizing of a long-distance competitor was an MCI. I believe it was customer service, maybe operator center in Michigan.
No operators. Southfield, Michigan. Again, it's not a fluke. It's District 4. Mm-hmm. And you have Bob and Jeff. And you have total support for that effort. It's not a fluke. He could talk about why that happened. I don't know.
No, I mean, it was a target, and it made sense. And we had, you know, some great structure in place already. So it was, you know, you had a perfect setup with Larry now taking on this organizing notion. And Bob, who was just
amazing,
a great leader. I mean, he just... talk about somebody who's just loyal to the union. He, when the union was going in this direction, that's exactly the direction Bob was going on with all of his heart and soul. And so, you know, he climbed right on board, even though that in some ways was not the model that he necessarily had grown up with. You know, he, like I, had grown up under the Marty Hughes top-down sort of model.
Yeah, but you had your own history, I would say.
Yeah, and so did Bob. I mean, Bob had his down in Portsmouth.
That's right. Bob was a firebrand.
Yeah.
Bob Johnson.
He's amazing.
Yeah. He had some wonderful stories about organizing activity down in Southwestern Ohio. Yeah. Southwestern Ohio.
Portsmouth
area. There's he proudly would bring out a copy of Look magazine from back in the 50s somewhere. About the strike in Portsmouth that had gone on for, I think, 7 months or something. And some of the stories that Bob talked about out of that strike, they had one guy who wouldn't join the union, and they found him up a pole one day, and they brought out some gas cans and doused the base of the pole and said, are you ready to join yet? And he joined.
Who was the employer?
It was General Telephone of Ohio.
Yeah, that's important. You asked a great question without knowing the answer. I was going to interject that.
Yeah.
The fact that Johnson came from General, it's very different than the bureaucratic union that, for the most part, not Ohio Bell, existed in the Bell system. There was, as you well know, the history of that was bureaucratic. It wasn't CIO. In 48, it got merged into TWOC, the Telephone Workers Organizing Committee, which had a very different history. But General was never part of that. You had to fight like hell to survive for the union. And remember, Portsmouth, Ohio is on the river. It's basically a southern town that's in southern Ohio. The other side of the river is the south.
Yeah.
And Johnson was amazing. And that's the kind of people in my whole life that mentored me. He was just, right now, chokes me up. He was an incredible leader. And the fact that because he was also a soldier, he followed Marty everywhere to the very end, Marty Hughes, and did what Marty asked. But he understood what it meant to organize, how you should bargain, how you build a union, as much as anybody that's ever lived.
How did he mentor you, Larry?
Well, Jeff, you start that how he mentored you.
I asked you.
Well, all right, just take my own privilege for a minute. I'll come after. He mentored Jeff a lot more than me. That's how I got to know Jeff. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, he mentored me, obviously, in that role. He was my supervisor, and it was by example. I literally shadowed Bob for 3 or 4 years. He wanted me, he deliberately, without me knowing it at the time, was grooming me to eventually become the vice president. And he just, made a point of engaging me in every single discussion about any kind of policy, anything that was happening in the union.
What were the lessons?
The lesson that I got from Bob more than anything was just this intense loyalty to the union. There were times when, Marty would say, we're going to do something, and Marty Hughes, and Bob Johnson would be absolutely polar opposite on it, but when those were the marching orders, we marched. And that was the sense of we're gonna stick with the union no matter what. He gave me that, and plus also this sense of engaging others. He did it with me, and then I tried to do it with basically the rest of the staff. I told the staff early on when I became vice president, look, I want you to be able to think and act independently. If we screw up, we'll screw up together, and we'll take ownership of it, but I will defend you, to the end, no matter what decision we make. And that gave them more of a sense of being able to do things and accomplish things rather than just, all right, here's the marching orders, go to march. It sort of emboldened their creativity to do different things. And that's where you come up with the Seth Rosens of the world, the John Ryans, the people that, these creative thinkers that can, really take a problem and attack it head on. And I, I attribute that to Bob, who was comfortable enough in his own skin and his own knowledge and level of knowledge to engage others that maybe knew more than he did and be willing to take their advice.
Sorry.
Yeah, no.
I want to shift in this question.
I'm just going to get some water running out of that water.
Let's hold on.
Drop some.
It does make me thirsty. Do you want more water?
Or cider?
I'm okay. I've been drinking.
You want a glass of cider?
No, I'm fine. Oh. I've been drinking.
Anyway,
we've been talking a lot about militance, about creativity. seems to me, I'd like to hear you both talk a little bit about strategy. We're building power at the same time in order to be effective with militant and creative strategies and tactics. One has to have an analysis of how much power you have.
Yeah.
So I'd like to listen.
Yeah, well, we use that terminology in every bargaining, number one, but also in the country as a whole. What's political action? It wasn't that way for labor, but political action should solely be about, I want to be happier. And what does that mean? So if I'm running for dog, you don't run for dog catcher, but city council, board of education, it should be about happiness, not about winning an election. Now, that's totally fucked up in this country, but to this day, that's what I, you know, preach, teach, do. But that became, you know, because of the Bob Johnsons, he totally got that. The Vic Crawleys, that's District 6. So for me, you know, District 1 was complicated. We'll leave it at that. But, you know, tens of thousands in District 1, that's a lot. But the leadership of 4 and 6, and eventually when Harry Ipsen was in 9, and that seesawed a bit, but Harry had the same kind of political culture as Jeff did, and, you know, a little bit different than Bob in terms of where he came from, but political culture. And that's, and with Morty leading, but me organizing, you know, and in my own world, the jobs with justice, organizing, you know, helping new people organize in new units, contract mobilization, it was Bob and Jeff, it was Crawley, it was Harry Ibsen, and, you know, the others were fine, they weren't excited about it. Eventually Noah Savant in 3, but that didn't last that long.
So having the district vice president supportive was critical.
And then how you work with the executive board. I mean, I'm basically an organizer since I was fighting Rizzo, you know, learned and chose to do that. I mean, that was a choice. I didn't have to do that. So organizing is about, you know, it's two words. It's broader and deeper. Broader means more people. Deeper means more activity in a certain, not just quantitative, but it's more strategy, you know, more power analysis and building power deeper. But so when I looked at the CWA board, you know, I sort of knew, not, I didn't know any of them except Morty and Jan when I came to that job. You know, I knew my world that was very much embedded in New Jersey, politically and in every way. You know, I moved from Philadelphia eventually to just on the other side, literally from one side of the river to the other. I lived on the river, on the New Jersey side. So, because I was also emotionally totally Philadelphia, not New York. And you know, to bring this back, I looked at the CWA board, and, you know, it gave me a lot of pause about, you know, taking that job on, you know, for a million reasons. But, you know, I was sort of, you could call it scared or horrified or both. And it's not just that board, you know, you're the organizing director. I can tell you my stories, which we don't need to. I should tell one about Jobs with Justice at the AFL-CIO. I mean, the AFL-CIO was a horror show. And it had its own history of who, of the bureaucrats who took it over, the way that, you know, the, at the time, two officers functioned, where they came from, what they were like. And they were ideological. They were sectarian. They were rooted in, you know, what I later learned were the Shackmanites of the world, or the what became the Social Democrats, the split-offs from the Socialist Party. So anyway, I didn't know any of that, but I sure got a taste of it in a hurry. When we started Jobs with Justice. But that the board, it became clear to me that in their own way, overwhelmingly, they were very, very decent. But I had to build up alliances. You know, and some people to this day don't think that way. I obviously, Sandy Rusher is my organizing director, love. And Ed Sable before her. You know, literally love both of them. But anyway, but for me, in that period, to make that move, you know, I had to figure out that board. Well, you don't do that in whatever they were at the time. There weren't that many. We had those national directors, so maybe there were 14, mm-hmm. I don't know, 15.
Yeah.
I forgot about them. They disappeared, but then we brought in the sector and then the diversity, right, which I'm very proud of, Jeff and I and winning that vote and getting that done. But I knew I had to, you know, organize inside, you know, that half your time with that board, not around them. A lot of people would just work around them. I don't like that. And four was like a godsend for me. And then six, and Crawley wasn't there initially. I don't remember the years. I could make it up. Jeff would be happy if I made it up. Yeah.
And believe it.
But, you know, I'd go to St. Louis and stay in his house with him and his wife and his daughter and the other son who was, and the other daughter had moved out. But, you know, this was like, you know, they were everything to me.
Maybe we
built the transformation, particularly, you know, the fight to organize wireless, which was huge, because the contract language from 86, the company said, just like they're saying now with the agents, this is something I'm still meddling in a very heavy way. Half the retail stores are now agents. And I worked with Abruzzo. She did all the work, but on this joint employer and on CEMEX,
Jennifer
majority signer.
Abruzzo, who's now the chief, who was
general counsel of NLRB.
And
was the deputy.
Special counsel at CWA for a period.
She was called special counsel. That's a whole other story we won't get into.
Yes.
Anyway,
what I wanted to, you were going to the wireless organizing story.
Yeah, well, I was tying it into, also right now, to me, the big membership crisis, which, you know, we got to get, it's not my job to get people's head around that, so I have to work with Kula to do that. But Tom Smith, Derek Acevedo, there's a crisis in terms of, do they own stores like Starbucks, or are they all kind of franchised like McDonald's? Mm-hmm. And because of the change of, all brought about by Jennifer, literally, a majority sign up and joint employer, much better joint employer than we had with the Obama board. It's very clear, and the 1986 language, that we have a gold mine here. That's a bad choice of words. But we have a golden opportunity, not forget the mine, to use the 25,000 members at AT&T retail with the more than 25,000 now who work in the agents. But that notion, it's the same notion that that we developed and we had, and, you know, coming out of New Jersey, and I had, you know, and with Morty's support, which was essential. But you had to win over in a deeper way vice presidents. Well, you're not going to get, how many did we have then? We initially had 10. I forgot. A bunch of them merged along the way here.
Yeah. Talk more about.
But winning over the District 4,
right,
was key, and then District 6. And in District 6's case, because they weren't SBC, and, you know, they were Ameritech. And we had a fight
district,
there that they
district
helped.
District 6 was SBC.
I know, but then it became it merged with AT&T. And so I don't know the year for that either. It was the first merger. So AT&T, however we want to describe it, you described it as long distance. It's complicated what it was, but AT&T bought and merged with SBC. But initially, yes, SBC, which had the same paragraph about majority sign up and neutrality. And so, you know, the origins of organizing at wireless were in District 6. It could have been somewhere else, but it was in District 6. And it was because of Vic Crawley, who for decades before I knew him was totally committed to this kind of organizing. Mm-hmm. And eventually he gets elected. You know, in 86, the vice president was very different than him. I'll just leave it at that. Mm-hmm. But when he became vice president, that was the strongest. And we created then a board organizing committee. You know, this is a version of organizing inside. Board organizing committee, Crawley is the chair. Jeff was on it, but it was probably before you.
Yeah. Oh.
So, you know, getting people on that committee who had this view. It wasn't just me, it wasn't Morty. It was that we had a team.
Would you consider the wireless organizing of it went from SBC, which bought Pacific Telesis, and a condition of support for that merger from CWA was winning the neutrality and card check language in both companies. in the merged company.
Well, you're talking about Four Wireless, because we had that language, but it was narrowly defined.
And it was only in the long lines contract. It was not in the SBC contract, and it was not in the Pacific Belt contract.
I don't think that's right. I
know it's right.
Well, we have to check it, because I would argue that it was not for... It was an argument internally about... particularly about wireless. But anyway, keep going. We don't have the contracts here. It's not going to matter.
Well, SBC merged with Ameritech.
After it bought Pacific Telesis. That was the first merger.
Pacific Telesis was the first. Okay.
That's before they merged with AT&T?
Yes. And then SBC actually acquired AT&T. Not the other way around. AT&T didn't acquire SBC.
It was more of a merger, but okay.
Yeah. I mean, and basically... Whitaker was acquiring the name more than anything. It was still...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And as part of the condition at Pacific Telesis and then later at Ameritech, they had to agree to give us card check recognition in exchange for our support at the various utility commissions around the regions that had to have approval. So, I mean, but that, again, the genesis of that is down in District 6 and the work that Crowley and Cohen did to make it happen.
5 years to card check. Where I was going with this was, would you consider the process that went on to gain recognition at Wireless, what eventually became AT&T Wireless, was not originally one of the biggest organizing successes after the state worker campaign?
You know, I would say there's a number of those that... in their own way, you know, were key, you know, including, you know, Lucent wall-to-wall, you know, manufacturing, including, you know, in a gigantic way, the U.S. Airways, later acquired by American, which is 22,000 people today, and that took years. But even things like the Wall Street Journal, it was not through the gilding, that was our own effort, and getting majority sign-up in all their companies, so they've got Market Watch, so we get majority sign up and the guild sort of adopting that strategy. And then, you know, in New Jersey, we actually got it in, you know, after I had gone to this job and position. But by law, majority sign up for public workers. And then in New Mexico, we were involved in all these things. It wasn't just CWA. So, and then, you know, the origins of the Employee Free Choice Act with majority sign-up. And then the irony, of course, that from 1949 to 69, that was board law, as it is again now. Of course, nobody, this is what I'm, one of my, you know, thing I work on, it drives me nuts, that nobody's working off of the CEMEX decision to bring back Joy Silk. The single most important thing that could ever happen here.
Could you explain that? What Joy Silk?
Joy Silk said, you have a majority, like it or not, yeah, you can come here, but if there's a majority, you're going to bargain. And that was key, aside from the sit-down strikes in World War II. It's a key and often untold part of, you know, they work together, these things. They're not in isolation. But of why there was this continuing surge of organizing, you know, into the 1960s in the private sector. And then there's a whole parallel story about the public sector organizing. But in 69, I'll call them fucked up NLRB, before the Supreme Court reversed in oral argument on majority sign up. And, you know, Kennedy had appointed people like White, who was horrible, and the Supreme Court was happy in the decision, Gissel. Was the name of the case. I think it was Gissel's, it was a sewing machine company. Anyway, I don't know the official citation. But they reversed Joy Silk with the NLRB, you know, whatever you call it, literally in front of the court reversing. He was supposed to defend Joy Silk. It was a he. I don't know his name. The lawyer who argued for the AFL-CIO. And because the AFL-CIO was part of it, you know, people even like a Morty Barr, it went unnoticed. Well, one of the amazing things about Jennifer is she knew, and I knew this.
Jennifer Russo.
Yeah, is she was the core reason that she wanted to be general counsel, she had been deputy and she worked there 23 years and got fired by Trump, but was to bring back Joy Silk. And within a week of being confirmed, which was a split vote, she got one more vote than she needed, or exactly what she needed, I don't remember. She put out a memo, we're bringing back Joy Silk. And when I say she put out a memo, except for the small number of employees who work for the board members, all the regional directors and all the lawyers, they all work for her. And she put this thing out in August of 2021. And, you know, she's a very close friend of mine, and but she gets all the credit. But I'm like her cheerleader and political, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the point being that the consciousness, even today, of how important that decision is, and of what we lost, and, you know, and no consciousness that we're now it's much worse. We are far worse than Mexico in terms of organizing rights. Far worse. And that didn't happen. You know, Mexico got better. It was part of it. Part of it was Trump and the USMCA agreeing to language that Democrats and our side of labor brought.
MCA?
USMCA, US-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement. Yes. That has, you know, better rights for Mexican workers organizing with an advisory board from the U.S. than what we have here. And that drives me nuts. But the fact that it's not reciprocal. There's no board looking over what goes on here. But the point being that this notion of your bargaining will turn to shit if the majority of workers in the country have no real right to organize, not a titular right, not a ceremonial right, and at 6%, it's shit everywhere. CWA, despite the bargaining power that the union as a whole had and that board knew they had, particularly at AT&T, but even to some extent in a general, and to some extent in New Jersey, we had organized a lot of people, and mostly they, not always, split, but anyway, particularly when there's a Democratic governor, enormous bargaining power without doing mobilization or political mobilization. But CWA embraced this idea that, and that's the core of Jobs with Justice, that there's no democracy when there's no ability to organize and bargain. And again, to tell her, that's every morning she wakes up with only that on her head, Jennifer Aruza. There's not a single union president that wakes up in the same way with that in their head. And yet every bargaining, whether it was the UAW or you know, the CWA bargaining coming up this year in AT&T, or you know, Warrior Met, where the workers were on strike for over a year, had to go back without any agreement. You know, that's the mine workers. That's the most militant, still, union in a car. It's shrunk and shrunk to 20,000. But they know what solidarity is.
My understanding is Jobless Justice, beyond what you said, the core understanding is also about labor community.
Oh, yeah. Well, the idea is we have so few union members that we have to build organization. And this was true until recently there. It's more functioning in a different kind of way. Fine, but it's not. But the core was you sign this pledge card. I'll be there whether you're a union member or not. I'll be there five times a year for somebody else's fight as well as my own. That's the way we can start winning. It was based on, you know, at that time in 1987, 20% are organized. It's probably 18. We're going. That's going to continue to drop. The only way we win is that people can join something and build something that they have equal ownership in, whether they're in the union or not, and that we will have, you know, an organizing committee in the cities where we build this that will have, you know, that picture. That picture is meant to represent, you know, flight attendants, miners, farmers, community organizations, you know, it's black, Latino, white, men and women. And that was all very conscious in 87. As I said, we added I like triangles, but we added the woman on the right because I also like equality.
And my understanding is the specific event was back to the closing of the MCI Customer Service Center and
yeah.
Trying to build a labor community coalition to fight that and saying, oh my God, we have to recreate these things every single time we have a fight.
That's exactly right.
Organization.
That's right. But also let's teach people that they can build and join things that can not only build power, but make them happier because we can win. Winning was key.
Winning is important, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's so many topics. I don't want to stop before you've talked about the fight over the Employee Free Choice Act.
Well, if you don't mind me saying this, the AT&T strike of 2004, which my brother here was, you know, more key than I was, even though I was EVP, because he was the vice president still. That was his last year of District 4. And, you know, so maybe...
Talk about that.
Our collaboration on that, your leadership of that, with me supporting.
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, it was this notion of trying to build something, but, you know, retain some kind of control over the action. In a typical strike, you go out and strike, you're handing the keys off to the employer as to, you know, what happens next. Well, you know, what we talked about, and we then engaged Andy Milburn down in Texas, and now I'm remembering our contracts were on a different time frame than the Pacific Telesis.
Uh-huh.
So the Ameritech contract and the SBC contract had a common expiration,
uh-huh.
And the Pacific Telesis one didn't. For whatever reason, I don't remember what that was. But now we were trying to recall this earlier today, why, you know, there wasn't somebody from District 9 there.
We talked about where we met for coffee or breakfast or lunch, and Jeff was saying, well, there are only three of us there, and I'm thinking, well, what happened to California?
Yeah, right.
And this is before Bell South, huh?
Where yes, before Bell South was in the mix, and so, you know, we came up with this notion of let's do a specifically timed strike. You know, it'll give, it'll build solidarity within the bargaining unit. People will be engaged. They'll be, you know, wanting to take place in this. And at the end of that, it'll send a clear message to the company that, you know, these people really do care about what's happening at the bargaining table. And at the same time, not leave it to the company to determine when the strike was over by, you know, doing whatever they're going to do at the bargaining table. So we would retain control to treat it as more of a tactic than an overall strategy. This is, you know, this is a way for us to attack the, you know, the employer, but maintain control over that attack. And so the two of us had talked about it, and we thought, well, let's, you know, we got to get Andy Milburn, who was the vice president of District 6 at the time, engaged. We brought him along, and he was all on board with it, if I recall.
May have taken some.
It took a little while, but, you know, because he was more of the notion of, you know, we're going to go on strike, and, you know, this, you know, we'll stay out until, you know, the contract is resolved, and that just didn't make sense in the context of where we were today. You know, it just it completely disengaged us from where the path was going to go. So we wanted to retain it, and he bought in with it, and then we gave Larry the job of taking this tactic to Morty, and he called us in the office then. Morty,
he sat there,
the three of us, he'd been having conversations with the company, trying to get things resolved, trying to move things along, and wasn't entirely thrilled with it because, you know, it was going to subvert some of the relationship that he had built up with the CEO at the time, Ed Whitaker. But he went along with it begrudgingly. And I think it turned out to be a great strategy. People felt good about the contract. I think we ratified the contract with higher numbers than we had in the past because they felt some ownership of it. They felt like they'd done something to make this happen. And in fact, they had. You know, they were able to use a tactic that, you know, that they'd come to taught that a strike was some never-ending thing or potentially never-ending to, all right, it's a finite piece of action that we can take.
And, you know, we talked about the legal ramifications of it. We can't do intermittent strikes, but you can strike once.
It's not protected activity, right. Intermittent strike. You
right.
can do it.
Right.
But you'll get noticed.
There'll be risk. Yeah. But, you know, you could go out once and bring them back, and that was still a protected activity. So.
And why did that increase the leverage to get a good contract, a four-day strike?
So my dilemma up in District 4 was we've got a pretty solid group up there in terms of, you know, being able to engage and activate people. But it was a little different down in District 6. I mean, you got a little bit of a mixed bag.
That's
where you got right to work down there. So, it's always a little daunting wondering, you know, anywhere through the South what a strike is going to look like in terms of who goes out and who doesn't go out. But this was a way to get people engaged where there wasn't this sense of uncertainty for them. They knew they were willing to sacrifice 4 days of pay in order to send a message. Would they also be willing to sacrifice a month's pay, 2 months' pay, three months' pay? Yeah.
I understand that.
And so that engaged, so that got everybody engaged in a way that they otherwise wouldn't have been. And then the message to the company was, wow, these people really are paying attention to this contract fight in a way that wouldn't have happened had we called a regular strike. And so that translated to leverage at the bargaining table that you could feel. I mean, you could feel when you went back to they were angry. The company was angry. They were not prepared for this tactic. They didn't think we were going to go on strike. And so, you know, we upset the apple cart for that 4-day period that we were out. But at the end of it, they recognized that this potentially could lead to something more drastic. And we got a decent agreement as a result of that.
Okay. Just to...
That was unprecedented in this country at that time. And it was 100,000 people just...
Yeah.
Earlier today, I looked up the New York Times article on it. And again, what I would chime in would be that, bargaining needs to be about being happier. It's the same as political work. And that, for the most part, strikes by then had become the leverage. You didn't necessarily gain leverage because you had to worry about, the one day longer. That was our slogan, each day, one day longer, each day stronger. But that's not necessarily reality. If, you know, even with, by then we had, I don't know if it was $300 a week, but some version of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely was a cushion for people. But the burden goes to every single family on strike. And that leads to a settlement. And again, my own background, and Jeff helped lead this much more than I did, but I played a role in it. And I then, you know, Whitaker refused to talk to Morty. I ended up the one dealing, in addition to dealing with this, dealing with Whitaker.
The CEO of SBC.
Right. A year later I was the president of the union and Stevenson replaced Whitaker, but as CEO. So this all, in a certain way, worked out. But the more important part was that the members knew what they were committing to and were happy to do it. And, in my opinion, a better bargaining strategy than a strike, because we would have had the burden, which the company so totally understood, of, well, it's not necessarily one day stronger. Mm-hmm. Because you're at a certain point, and Morty often used this language, not to a fault, by the way, you know, we have to measure continuing this against, you know, what we're going to gain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think we'll gain anything more than this. And meanwhile, the company's thinking, well, they're going to agree to what they have at some point. Well, you take that off the table with this tactic. And as you saw in the New York Times article, Jeff saw, you know, national public attention on these tactics. Mm-hmm. And 100,000 people.
Yeah. Right. So now that I'm getting my head wrapped around it.
Employee Free Choice Act came after that, by the way. So.
Yeah. Well, so this was a strike. SBC, by this point, had bought Pacific Telesis and Ameritech.
Mm-hmm.
Had not yet bought Bell South. That's why they weren't involved.
Right.
And the long distance AT&T had not yet been bought.
Right. That's right.
So you were
two districts,
right.
You don't remember why California wasn't involved, going on strike, and SBC was, and you had different contracts.
Right.
Jeff's
right.
saying California had a different expiration date.
Yeah.
That's why they weren't involved in the strike. That's what Jeff said. I don't know the dates.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember
either, to tell you the truth.
Which, unfortunately, the agreements were made.
Yeah.
Some VPs stayed out,
right.
districts stayed out, others didn't, and
well, some added a year to get something, and you know, things like that.
Yeah, and it broke up the something we'll never get back, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
But it really was the notion of asking people to sign a check for their 4 days of pay that they were going to contribute to the cause, versus asking them to sign a blank check.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know you got much deeper buy-in. People, it was a party out on the picket line. I mean, these people were out there celebrating. They were having a great time. It was, I think it was the summertime. Anyway, it was great. It was good weather.
Good weather, yeah.
Yeah. And again, the big thing for me was at the end of the day, they felt real ownership of the contract. They didn't feel like, oh, at the end of the strike, we just gave in to whatever was on the table. We didn't really win what we wanted to win. And it really enabled us to help build the union after that.
And the company moved as a result of
Yeah, the company moved. I mean, there were, if I recall, there was some employee health, retiree health care issues. There were
health care, period, yeah.
Yeah, health care was a big, in fact, in the New York Times article, one of the analysts talks about how much more it was going to cost the company in healthcare costs as a result of this contract, because they, at that time, wanted us to pay for a fair portion of our healthcare. They wanted us to, I forget what the number was at that moment, but they backed off of that, and it was a big deal. It's one of these things where it's taking red shirts to another level.
Absolutely.
You know, you're asking
highest
people
level.
To, yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but I want to try and keep the conversation
sure.
somewhat. So I feel like Employee Free Choice Act we need to talk about, and your 10 years of presidency, I'm not sure what other topics, but how maybe some internal, you did some major efforts at restructuring the
yeah.
union during that period.
Yeah.
And so I think that might be another thing. But any other major topics that are on?
No, we can go with that.
Yeah, I think that'll.
So talk.
I mean,
about
you know, in my realm, and Jeff was there at the beginning of it. You know, the fight to change the Senate rules, expanding the booklet, doing training 50,000 people about democracy and how that directly affects, you know. The line down, I don't remember if it was 6% by then, but close to it, that our political power and working class political power, you know, was directly tied to collective bargaining and to the lives and well-being of our families and communities. But the democracy part of that, not just who do you elect, as I say, the rules, not just the rulers, came from that. And, you know, we built the Democracy Initiative, another pamphlet there out of that.
Who were the main folks in the Democracy Initiative? Who was
Greenpeace, Sierra Club, NAACP, and CWA.
So what led you to...
Anyway, that's not till 2012.
December 2014.
Yeah, well, that's the pamphlet, mm-hmm. 2012.
Right. Well, let's talk about Employee Free Choice Act.
Right, so the simple thing is, take the lessons from CWA, the crisis in the country, put them together. And by that time, you know, 18 years of Jobs with Justice, that had limits. How do people in the largest, in the wealthiest democracy in the world, with the worst bargaining rights, how do you reverse it? So the core of the Employee Free Choice Act was majority sign up and first contract arbitration. So it was simple, much simpler than the PRO Act. And the PRO Act, awfully, I would say, they eliminated majority sign up. It's not in the PRO Act. Deliberately,
thinking that majority sign-up is somewhat anti-democratic and why it didn't pass, which is, there's absolutely no basis for that. But anyway.
Neutrality is not in
FK. You can't legislate neutrality in the United States because of First Amendment rights for employers. So you're immediately up against the Supreme Court. What you can do, which Abruzzo said, so we're now at a point where Abruzzo and the board, because of her leadership, are ahead of the PRO Act, and almost none of the union presidents have any understanding of that. So joint employer majority sign up. There's other things that are fine in the PRO Act, by the way, about secondary boycotts, but they're not the core of what the problem is here. I absolutely support eliminating secondary boycotts. But in any case, it does not have neutrality because, you know,
okay,
the labor lawyers that I was closest to in my own understanding. So when I got elected president, I immediately was asked by Sweeney to chair the organizing committee of the AFL-CIO.
John Sweeney, president of AFL-CIO.
Yeah. And I did that the whole 10 years. And so I obviously, you know, whatever you want to call it, organized, it's top-down organizing, but that we needed to confront more than anything as a federation. You know, they don't agree on all kinds of things, political and otherwise, but agree on that the sole thing we should wake up with every morning is, you know, the chart that you see in almost everything that I had anything to do with. So even in this thing on building democracy, you know, the very first page, this is training 50,000 CWA shop stewards. It's all rooted in that.
This is the
jobs with justice was all rooted in that chart.
This is the chart on page one that shows the rise and fall of private sector collective bargaining from 13% in 1930 to 36% in the early 50s, down to 6.6%. This chart ends at 2012.
And it's now 6.5. So it did level off. Okay, you have to pardon not to level off when you're that low. And there's another chart that shows the other countries of the world. Is that right there?
Yeah, and page three.
It's collective bargaining coverage, part of the problem in the U.S. It's too often called union density. It's called union membership because we're focused on what is our membership. And too often that's about dues as well, as opposed to what's our power. And the power, France is the big example, is collective bargaining coverage. They don't focus on union membership.
So you were chair of the organizing committee.
And got people to agree, not just the committee, but obviously Sweeney, that we should rise and fall over the collapse of U.S. labor law in terms of bargaining and organizing rights. That we should just take that on, rise or fall.
And I know
it's 2006 or 7, the origins of it. I think that's what I'm trying
Larry,
to remember.
How would you sum up for an outsider of why U.S. labor law is so weak?
So I would start with why do we have, why is
that's the impact, but what is it about the law?
Right.
And the way employers are allowed to function under
the
law.
Yeah, so it's the combination of no other country except for some provinces in Canada have the notion of a win-lose representation election where the employer campaigns on your right to bargain. So in every other democracy, it's presupposed you have a right to bargain, but if people don't join, there's not going to be any outcome. So in virtually every other democracy, they have sectoral bargaining, which is, again, for me, a whole other level of this. We don't have to get into that today. But where this is what's going on in Sweden right now with Musk. So they have sectoral bargaining. There's a contract for that sector. They're mechanics, so I don't know exactly how broad the sector is. But in any case, they're covered, led by Musk himself, he's a micromanager, they refuse to acknowledge that they're covered by a collective agreement. And now, at this point today, all through Scandinavia, that strike, it's 150 mechanics in Sweden, but they repair the Tesla vehicles, and all through Scandinavia, there's work actions involved, including, you know, in Sweden, the post office won't deliver license plates for Tesla. And the big fear, and so they made a colossal blunder. There's a lot of ways Tesla, even from their framework, could have dealt with it. They have totally screwed up. And it's very funny. It's now public that they're trying to hire somebody to deal with Nordic labor relations. You know, and they don't produce there. It's only the peripherals, mostly in this case, repair. But in Germany, is one of their, aside from China, it's probably the second biggest facility in the world. And Germany has sectoral bargaining. And Germany has IG Metall, a union we work with. We had a joint, Verdi is the one we mainly work with on T-Mobile. But we work with IG Metall on a number of projects. And it's already now come to the point where IG Metall is on a major membership drive because they have the same exact issue. They have sectoral bargaining for the metal sector. That's their sector. They're the dominant, almost the only union in the metal. It's bigger than steel or car. They have divisions like car, but and doesn't apply in the suburban Berlin factory of Tesla. And there's probably, I'm making up the number, 6,000 people there, as opposed to 160. So now he's got a giant problem. And of course, particularly given the UAW settlements at the three, and the fact that he has the Fremont plant, by the way, $495 million from Obama. And we could not get, I worked with Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, to get at the bottom line, to shorten this, that the people who work there in the General Motors, it's called the NUMMI plant with Toyota, a joint venture, they made a Corolla and they made the, I forgot the name of the Chevy, but anyway, Prism. The Obama government in that car crisis where they bailed out in bankruptcy, Chrysler and General Motors, Ford didn't go to bankruptcy, they gave $495 million to Musk. He hadn't made a car. And we met with Biden, the three of us, Biden, Ron, me. I was, you know, chair of the organizing committee, certain type of individuals, but very close to Obama and knew Biden, right? Two meetings. The first one was automatic rehire, successorship. Comes back, no, can't do anything. They wouldn't say to Musk, you're not getting the $500 million. And the story's worse and worse if I went into the details of the car czar, who worked there, where they are now. It's a horrible story about the lack of depth in the Obama White House and administration for workers' rights.
I just want to understand, this was a NUMMI plant that became a Tesla plant?
Yeah, it was a union plant.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
So anyway, we're back in the context of this.
Right, and employee-free choice there.
So it's very clear. It was very clear in 2005, probably right away we started on this. But I don't remember the first year bills were filed. I know that in the House, the first year the bill was filed, we didn't have a Senate majority then, but it passed by 65%, including 16 Republicans. So that had to be 2009 is what I would guess. No, it couldn't be, because in 2009 we also had, depending on how you count, 60 or 59 Democrats in the Senate. Anyhow, so it was the year before that. So in 2006 must have been the Pelosi speakership began, and we had, you know, we had one-on-ones. She embraced it. George Miller led it. He was my brother and friend and total amazing guy, and you know, he embraced it immediately. You know, Jody Calamine, who had worked at CWA as a young lawyer, was now working for George, and worked for George until George left, probably 2012-13. So it had to be 2007 or 8. Passes by 65% in the House with 16 Republicans, states like Michigan and Ohio, Republicans voting for it. And we couldn't get it on the floor of the Senate in 2009. So 2009, we have a Senate landslide, biggest since the Roosevelt years, 60 senators. That counts Kennedy, who had a major seizure. It's the main reason we never got it through. Martin Luther King, on Inauguration Day at the lunch, Kennedy had a seizure and never came back. came back for 1 hour for one vote, and wouldn't resign. I didn't ask him to resign, obviously, but so we never got his seat replaced till he died, and then it was. And these are the details. And Obama, in a meeting with Obama, this is my own therapy. I realize it's not what this project's about. But with a bunch of union presidents, including Sweeney, we're in the Roosevelt Room right next to the Oval Office. And we go there for this. And Obama says to me, and I give the pitch, you know, most persuasive, and I know him well, right? You know, most persuasive way. He says, Larry, this is in front of everybody. I hear you well, but our priority is health care. And he probably made up a story that after health care, well, he never got to health care. We end up on an abomination from my point of view, the Affordable Care Act, barely better than nothing. We did support it. And then Scott Brown wins.
In Massachusetts.
Yeah. And so we're nowhere near, we still have a supermajority, but at that point we're probably at 58, 57. We don't have Blanche Lincoln for this.
From Arkansas, right?
Yeah.
No, Nebraska. Nebraska.
No, she's Arkansas.
Okay.
So, yeah. The corporate lobbyists, as soon as she left, like so many of them, Daschle and others. So in any case, the good news would be, and a nice pin in the box, metal pin of Employee Free Choice Act, I think you saw. But the good news would be that you could, not just me, but you could go to almost any union meeting in America and people knew what the Employee Free Choice Act was. That's one. Two, out of that campaign came Fix the Senate Now, which preceded Democracy. It's the same players. And out of that campaign, with Harry Reid as the leader at the time, all we could get was, we'll change the rules so that we can put a nomination on the floor. And the key is to put it on the floor, because even a bill, the bill is on the floor and discussed, you can pass it with a majority, but you can't put it on the floor without a cloture vote, they call it. And you need 60 under the current rules for cloture. There's a couple of exceptions. So anyway, out of this giant campaign that came from the Employee Free Choice Act for us, and then CWA put a huge resources, including a huge chunk of my time, into Fix the Senate Now, we got the rules changed on nominations. And people were saying, well, then the Republicans have a majority. What will they do? And I would say, they're going to do whatever they're going to do. That's backward thinking. And, you know, groups that I mostly like, NARAL, Planned Parenthood, will lose abortion rights. And I'd say to them, we don't have abortion rights. We have a court decision. We should be passing a law now for abortion rights, not resting on Roe. And who am I to say that? But I said it just like this, because they opposed Fix the Senate Now. Totally opposed it. But we got, you know, through the needle, we got, so we had no NLRB because they didn't have three members. We had no labor secretary. We had no, the newly, you know, Elizabeth Warren Consumer Financial Protection Board. No, the whole thing didn't, we had no leader of that. The thing didn't exist. We had no EPA commissioner. And more importantly, that's important enough, 300 judges were backed up. So it took 2 years to get that. We could not get what we wanted, which was a version of talking filibuster, which right now we still don't have. But the important thing would be that that executive board and our members, we did do this big education project like we did on contract bargaining and on Employee Free Choice Act, same thing, you know, with thousands of stewards off the job, embraced this.
That executive board means CWA?
Yeah. And eventually the AFL-CIO, not that long. And again, you know, I know how to argue this stuff when you're that right. It's not that hard to argue. And the same with the Trans-Pacific Partnership fight they took on. And they know it's not in their DNA to do those kind of campaigns.
And that was a victory.
That was a victory, yeah, in part because of the Bernie campaign and Clinton moving somewhat. And then most ironically, as Jeff so knows better than I do, you know, Trump embraced the Stop the TPP.
Right. Okay.
So we're still there with majority sign up, first contract, Abruzzo can't really fix first contract. She's helping, very focused on it, but can't do arbitration for first contracts by fiat. Can't dictate the agreement, but has done a lot on bad faith bargaining, including Starbucks. I mean, the problem is it's sort of endless.
Yeah.
So you have to, and the PRO Act does not have majority sign-up. It does have first contract arbitration.
Let's move to the topic of restructuring the union.
Uh-huh.
That a lot happened, and the finances.
Well, also the diversity.
Yeah.
For, you know, I would say as important as anything.
Okay.
For
talk about that.
For elected leaders from the union, they didn't have to be local presidents, but they all have been in diversity seats because it was too slow to change the makeup of the board. And, you know, we worked together on that. Annie worked on it. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. Things weren't moving quickly. We've definitely made inroads. The board looks different, even without the diversity seats, than it did when we first came into the union. But
that helped break that open. Claude
right.
From acting district vice president.
That's right.
Frank Arce.
Right. So, I mean, it really created not just a path, but a notion that this is something to be alert to and heads up to and pay attention to making our union.
What the it is.
Just diversity on the board. I mean,
no, but pretend it's not the three of us.
Yeah.
You know what it is.
Yeah, so.
What was the. It was a constitutional amendment.
Right, and it was. We took the union and broke it into, what, four different regions?
Yeah.
Yeah, combining districts. Some districts, and said that in each one of those districts, those combined districts would elect a diversity representative. To sit on the executive board and have all the same power and votes as an elected regional vice president or sector president or anybody else that sat on that board.
Without
the bargaining responsibility. Their responsibility was basically to bring a diverse view to the board deliberations. And I mean, clearly that's what they've done. I'm going to defer to my numbers wizard here.
Yeah, but I'm not great on parsing the year.
Yeah.
So okay. We would have to look
what
it up.
What qualified as diversity?
You couldn't legislate that, so anyone could run for it. But
right.
We created a culture where, you know, white male would have been totally embarrassed. I don't know that one ever ran. And so it mostly meant people of color, particularly African-American. In terms of the reality, but you couldn't legislate that because of the labor management reporting and what's the D stand for? LMRDA, I forgot what the D is. But you couldn't restrict who ran, but you could describe the purpose, and the result was fine because no white male ever ran for it,
right,
for any of them.
2007.
Okay, so that's. So
go.
Barbara was still there. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
My memory is she chaired the committee that came up with the proposal.
That came from, I don't want it to be about me. It didn't come from there.
Yeah, no. It came from the president's office. There's no question
and
about where it came from.
Was very involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I had, anyway.
Yeah.
You were driving it.
The minority caucus. So I used to go to those meetings. It's, you know, it goes back to the Rizzo stuff. And the minority caucus helped drive it, and the board was great. The board drove it, and Barbara supported it. She didn't oppose it.
Yeah.
But it was driven. It had huge grassroots support from amazing leaders across the union.
And it just made sense. I mean, it really did try and bring us into the 21st century. You know, I mean, it was much more. It created a board that's much more reflective of who the union is. Something that had been missing since its inception, you know, since day one of the union. So, you know, I feel very good about the progress we've made in changing that dynamic.
Yeah. And initially, the minority caucus said to me, we want a direct, we want a representative. And, you know, I thought about that for a while and said, you know, that's not going to change anything. We're going to do four.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted it to come from them? As
no, they didn't care about that. They would have been happy with electing it.
Yeah, yeah. And it did more than just change the diversity. I think it also changed the perspective. I mean, these were local leaders.
That was deliberate, too.
Yeah, these were local leaders now on this board that, you know, brought a different mindset and a different set of concerns to board discussions in a way that you couldn't have accomplished with any other process. So it was really a twofer, although it was advertised as just diversity.
Yeah, for us it was as much this, not as much, but secondarily that it'll change the way the board behaves at meetings.
Right.
Because they were likely going to be, you know, huge local leaders, not like token local, you know, they've got to get elected in these combined districts. And so you got Carolyn Wade, you got Claude Cummings, you got Marilyn Elder, she was the West Coast, and, you know, she was a leader and organizer of Pride at Work, as well as being a woman president of Portland Local. And who was the fourth one that we had initially? I forgot. But anyhow, there were three of the four. I'd have to think through what region are we missing.
Mm-hmm.
You said Claude, you said Carolyn, you said Marilyn.
Oh, it would be yours.
No, six and four together.
So it would be three.
Yeah.
3-2-13.
Yeah, probably.
And there's probably a reason I'm not remembering who that was. anyway, we'll leave that go.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about...
But that was huge to get that done. Mm-hmm. And the enthusiasm around doing it ultimately, at the, you know, before the convention and at the convention, and then that initial election, and the embrace of those four, and the equality they had with, you know, people who had this huge staff and bargaining responsibility. They had full equality. They were not, you know, they had the same power to change the union as anyone else, including the president of the union and the secretary treasurer.
Talk about
and there were other things. What was our thing called when we got elected president, EVP? And Barbara was there for this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was very good at contributing but also going along. And she loved Jeff personally, not necessarily politically, mm-hmm. but personally. And that was deliberate, too. That was not why I was interested in Jeff. Right. But we put out a booklet with 10 changes.
Yeah.
What was that called? I would have that in a box in there, but I don't remember the
name. Yeah, it's in my
edit. You were there. You don't remember either?
Well,
one of them was this diversity.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Committee of the Future.
No, we didn't call it that.
No.
This
is way past
this
that.
This was after that? No, this is when we ran.
The two of us got elected together.
Before it.
This is 2005.
No, this is far after Committee of the Future. This is when we ran for office.
Yeah.
It was about, here's 10 changes. I think it could have been 11 because I like that number too. But it was 10 or 11 changes.
Ready for the future.
There you go.
Thank you.
With 11.
There you go.
11.
I like 11.
2006. Bold New Strategic Industry Fund.
Yeah.
We got that adopted.
We got that done.
National Telecom Office.
We got that done.
And then mandated that you bring to the 2007 convention specific proposals to increase board diversity.
Mm-hmm.
It also had things about eliminating meetings we didn't need. I would say that's reverted. Now, the good news about Zoom is now that has, you know, cut the number of meetings, Zoom, because they do Zoom meetings for a lot of them. But in some ways, that's reverted.
But the reorganization of the board and the strategic industry funding issues, talk a little bit about that.
No, go ahead. You do.
No, you go ahead.
No,
you did
no,
as
no,
much
no,
of that
no,
as anybody.
No.
I'd rather hear you do it first. Do you mind?
This is your time. They've got plenty of time with me anytime they want. Let's let you go through that.
I mean, so what's the exact question so I don't ramble around?
Sure.
The strategic industry funds and you know.
And then the growth fund.
Right.
That might not have been in that proposal. But the notion was that we need resources to build power by industry, even though, you know, we're not really set up by industry. And that we'll allocate the funds that way, and that we have this incredibly growing strike fund, and that you know, because of the 6% and other things, the practical consequences of a strike are not what they were and not sufficient. You know, they're important, but not sufficient. And so this notion, again, in mobilization of building power, building our power, not just where we work, but a lot of it is, you know, we used to talk about, say, with T-Mobile or Sprint, it's like all their employees are sitting with the management that we're bargaining with, but they're sitting there on that side of the table too, right? Because the company has to operate in a market economy. And so if we don't have sectoral bargaining, and this I actually worked on more after I left CWA than before, but if we don't have sectoral bargaining and don't have a sense of our industry and how we build power in the industry, along with the organizing challenge is the first contract problem, you know, it becomes hopeless, not hard. I used to say it's hard, but not hopeless. I said it a lot. Now I'm not so sure, but I never really will act as if it's hopeless, but and nobody else should either. But it's certainly gotten more hopeless. But that was the basis of the Strategic Industry Fund, and that we set a floor. You know, it's this, you were the Secretary Treasurer by then, or Barbara was, I don't remember. Anyway, Jeff was key on all this, yeah. Even though he wants me to talk about it. There was all administrative procedures so that the strike fund would never be in jeopardy. It was only the income from it, and it was only part of the income from it. And it was clear that here's the risk-reward. The reward is a lot greater than the risk. If we don't do this, you know, much broader sense of building power in our industries, including organizing in the industry only, and the people in the industry would make the decision, and that we, you know, we broadened the scope of the Defense Fund Oversight Committee, that they would be able to review what we did with the funds.
And what was happening to dues income during this period?
Well, I mean, you know, it reflective of the membership had been a fairly steady decline. You had in the telecom industry, the highest paid titles were declining at a much more rapid pace than anything else. The growth that we had was in, you know,
things like retail stores.
Yeah, where the, you know, the rates weren't as high, the wages weren't as high. So, you know, we were seeing a steady decline there. We're also juggling issues with the pension plan, and I mean, there, you know, there was a whole host of financial pressures to try and deal with things, and it just didn't make sense for us to be sitting on this huge amount of money that just continued to compound and use it for a tactic that, while not obsolete, had really become
Members, it wasn't effective.
Right. The majority of the members would never see a dollar from that fund. So wouldn't it make more sense to take a portion of that and invest that in building a union? And so that was the notion of it. And it took a little convincing. I mean, we had to do a roadshow and go across the country to try and convince people that this was the way it ought to go, because their notion was, oh, we got to have this in case we go on strike. You know, it's got to be here for us because, you know, our members have put the money in and they deserve that. Well, they deserve a union that is growing and building power. That's what they deserve. It's not about, you know, just making sure that somebody gets a $300 check in the third week of a strike. It's about making sure that there's power behind that strike or that action or that tactic, whatever it happens to be. And so trying to diversify the use of that fund was a big deal. It was a big sell. I mean, we had to work it. You know, like you said, we had to roll the Defense Fund Oversight Committee into it. So, you know, this notion that it wasn't just the executive board trying to grab the money, so that there was some rank and file oversight over it. You know, we made a number of different tweaks along the way to make sure that it was palatable for everybody and got a majority at the convention. And at the end of the day, it did. And I think a big turning point in trying to resolve the finances of the union and get it so that we could function going forward. I'm long gone now, but you know, some of the things that you did after I left, and that even Chris and others have done since then, using those dollars are much more creative than we were able to do in the past, where we were sort of hamstrung by our general dues income.
Chris Shelton, the president, came after Larry.
And a lot of these campaigns that we talked about, we funded by getting the leadership of that fund, that SIF fund, to support, like, the Employee Free Choice Act. We easily spent $2 million on that. We spent over $1 million on Fix the Senate Now. No other union was willing to do anything, or the AFL. I argued quite passionately, deeply believed, that's part and parcel about our own happiness and about the future of our jobs and our kids.
You know what? There's one more that we didn't talk about, international. And I think talking about T-Mobile and or the way in which you worked with the Mexican union around the complaint against Sprint are examples of your approach to international work. So why don't you very briefly?
Yeah, the familiar connection, La Conexión Familiar, it was important to me that people in our country, not just in our union, see that the U.S. was at the bottom in terms of many things, but you could list the things. But one of those things, obviously for a union, collective bargaining and organizing rights. I would always call it bargaining and organizing rights because it's the same thing. Too often it's organizing, and even worse is union density. I hate that term. Why is that important? Why is that a public good, union density? But anyway, bargaining and organizing rights. So, going back to the organizing effort that we made, particularly because of, states like Texas and Arizona and California sharing this huge border with Mexico, and realizing even then that that we're linked, and in my head, this turned out to be true, but I didn't know it would be true, that a reform movement in Mexico was much more likely to succeed than a reform movement in the United States. So I preach this all over the world, that I'm like Paul Revere in the American, I'm ringing the bell. We're going down the fucking drain. You should learn that, not that we have the best movies and music in the world. That's what you want to learn about the U.S., that the rights of working class people are being destroyed here. And copy us at your peril. And be on guard about American corporations, and blah, blah, blah. So Mexico, obviously, Canada is ahead of the U.S., right, in that period. Not much, but Mexico looks on the surface. So starting, back, and Morty was fine on this, Lou Moore, the international staffer, was not horrified. I'll leave that go, too, because we're recording here. We started a direction that said no more convention resolutions on foreign policy, none. Now, that went on until this started in the late 80s, because the resolutions were all like, propping up the State Department. We'll leave it at that. We don't have to say CIA. They meant nothing to the average member. We did have a convention resolution opposing, before it started, the war in Iraq. We're the only union to do it. So that was done because we have good and welfare at the end, and people did it in the way they're supposed to do it. It didn't come from the executive board. But until then, 25 years of no resolutions on foreign policy. But starting in the mid-80s, we did what we called cross-border organizing training in Espanol, solo. And we had, Eduardo Diaz and Virginia Rodriguez to run that. And, I went to a lot of it, tried to improve my Spanish, failed at that. But, it was a solidarity thing, too. And it was only in Spanish. And, recognizing, again, it goes to the diversity thing, that in those states particularly, but also other states, we have CWAs that are great organizers in Spanish, in their language. And so we should be running organizing training. Back in the 80s, we started the term with the AFL-CIO, totally with Organizing Institute. We ran our own. So we started to do that with the Telefonistas, as I call them, the STRM, long acronym. And, built bonds, particularly Eduardo, but also me, with Francisco Hernandez Suarez, the president of that union, but particularly Eduardo was loved and, you know, had been an organizer. I knew him from New Jersey, but then moved to work for the Texas State Employees Union as an organizer. And then when I got elected EVP, came, you know, went to the staff with me, and we had this, you know, whatever we want to call it. He wasn't there for international, he was there for organizing. But nonetheless, contradiction with Lou Moore.
And how did this come out in the Sprint campaign?
Well, you have Virginia Rodriguez, you have La Conexión Familiar. She's in California, she's the leader, staff leader of organizing. We call that organizing coordinator. And we had a national campaign at Sprint, and Sprint had a subsidiary, Sprint Employees Network. Rick Braswell ran, you know, as part of the organizing national effort. But so we had Sprint organizing, and you could join Sprint Employee Network without, this is something that went back to my time at SWAC and Texas State Employees Union. We had a number of examples where we built organization without bargaining rights. And we didn't call it minority, it was just membership organizing. You'll be as strong as you can be, just like SWAC was without CWA. Got stronger, but that's another story we already told. So Sprint Employee Network was that. Well, one of the places where that really took hold was La Conexión Familiar, which was about, at that time, if you lived in the U.S. and had family in Mexico or friends or anything, you called back there, that was a big revenue source. And so, you know, basically it was a Sprint subsidiary with service reps who, you know, helped in those transactions in the same way that the service rep in 4309 in Ohio Bell would have worked. Same work. Sprint fired everybody. And I went with Francisco and Maria Zelwansi, who's still very active in Mexico, to the Mexican Labor Commissioner. And we convinced him, I mean, they loved it, that was not a progressive government, to file charges against the U.S. under NAFTA. First time that was ever done, I'm not sure if it was done again. And, you know, they were horrified here, the Clintons, as I called them. But, you know, the AFL wouldn't pick it up in the way they should have. And, you know, got buried in reports, nothing ever got done. But, you know, it was an outrage.
And talk very briefly about TU.
So it's the same idea.
I mean, the I'm
sorry. TU is what you wanted.
The relationship with Verde.
Yeah, but that's TU.
Yeah.
So.
TU is T-Mobile United, right?
It was really, we just called it TU. It was a member organization that T-Mobile workers in the U.S. could join.
Okay.
It wasn't really an acronym. It's a whole history of that. It had to do with being sued by them for using their name. So we never used their name, meaning T-Mobile. Yeah, I had a number of those, as you know. The big, the most famous was, "Can you hear me now?" You know, contempt of court with Verizon for using their slogan and winning that contempt of court. I still remember Marion Melvany saying, "Larry, you'll go nowhere near the courthouse where this is being adjudicated," which happened to be in Trenton, and it happened to be he's the one who died. What was his name? Aaliyah? How do you say his last name? I'm forgetting his name. Supreme Court. Scalia, that's it. I forgot his name. Thank you, Hannah, the youngest one. Scalia was a federal judge, had the jurisdiction for this case in Trenton. And Scalia agreed with CWA. It was not contempt of court. Anyhow, TU, forgetting about the name, that's where the name came from.
And the relationship with Verdi.
Yeah, it was created jointly by Frank Bezierska. Verdi was with IG Metall, the two largest unions in Germany. Because they have a long tradition of sectoral bargaining, you know, membership is more complicated there. But 2 million members, the whole services sector, including most of the public sector services, but maybe not most, but large, it was both. And Deutsche Telekom was a huge, a significant part of Verdi. Verdi is an acronym that stands for United Services Union in German. Don't ask me to say what it stood for, meaning the German. It was long. And the initial chairman, they called it, of of overall verity was Frank Bozierska, who had ironically come from the Green Party, which is different in Germany than anything, you know, they have huge membership in parliament, electeds in parliament, a different system there that allows for that. And they recruited him from the Green Party to come and lead Verdi when they formed Verdi. Verdi was a merger of a bunch of services unions in the early 2000s, the aughts as we call it. And I had a series of meetings with him at global meetings, and he was very decent, and we became friends. And I convinced him and then Lothar Schroeder and others who were leading the Deutsche Telekom part that, and we had were doing work. So for about 10 years, I chaired the telecom, they call it president, but it's a meaningless title, of the global unions in telecom before I was president of the union. And built that around joint work at multinationals. And particularly that, and Jeff was involved in this, so we could go to him. So Ameritech was New Zealand, Belgium,
Hungary.
Mm-hmm. Is that it?
Yeah.
They were the dominant telecom in those countries. So there was a capital strategy at that time that the U.S. companies needed to go global. So anyway, we, and Jeff was either vice president by then, or anyway, he was in charge of that. What did we call the Ameritech group? It had some name.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'll think of it after we're done recording.
So we were doing that kind of work. Vodafone, which was a major player in the U.S. with the British unions, they were a renegade there too. They were no collective bargaining there in the U.K. And they were gobbling up all over the world, as they still are. They're not gobbling up now; they're shedding. But so we had a Vodafone group, we had an Ameritech group, and so I go to Bozierska and say, "Okay, Deutsche Telekom is using the same brand, not a different brand, T-Mobile in the U.S." They're totally organized, as you know, and you know, I went to a lot of work sites sort of pitching this, you know, with their blessing, obviously, with their leaders in Germany, and was shocked by what I saw, even for me, the difference in, you could go to a call center, you know, anywhere, I went to only a few, and the union members ran the call center. You know, there might have been a manager there who wasn't in the union, but they had nothing to do with how it was run. And so, you know, what I pushed in particular was, I don't want this to be meet, greet, and eat global unionism. And that's still what it mostly is, meet, greet, and eat. You get a plane ticket, you get a hotel, and you get a lot of food and a waste of time. And so we don't want this to be the bureaucrats in our unions. We want it to be call center workers with call center workers. So we actually, and I said, you know, they'll join an organization which we should decide jointly how it's run. That was the TU. And that at some point, I wasn't involved in or consulted, but the CWA dropped their support for that. Meaning after I left as president, so call it 2017, 18. Do you know when? You were still there.
I was definitely still there.
Totally, because your responsibility that happened.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Debbie would have kept anything progressive going.
We were this close, and my fingers are very close together, to getting some kind of neutrality and organizing rights agreement as T-Mobile was buying Sprint and was being sued not by the Trump administration, but by the states, led by New York and California. And Letitia James, who has proved to be an amazing attorney general, said to CWA, "What is it you need?" And we told her, and she was adamant that she would not sign off on pulling back the suit until we got what we wanted. She was amazing. Unfortunately, Becerra out in California, who was the AG, did not have the same kind of...
The same guy fucking a snail.
So, anyway, we were this close.
I didn't know that about Becerra. That's amazing.
Well, we had no... We didn't have much political power in California either. It was a very different union relationship and structure. Ultimately, the CEO of T-Mobile, John Ledger, was calling Chris. It was Chris was president, at least once a day, and they would reach an agreement, and then T-Mobile's lawyers would negotiate with Jody Kalmine, and what the lawyers were permitting was, you can have organizing rights in one call center for 1 year. It's something so ridiculous, and we'd reject it. Anyway, the upshot was that the judge in the case decided he couldn't second-guess T-Mobile and Sprint statements that this would be good for consumers, and he let it go through. And that was pretty much the end of the possibility of us having the kind of leverage to move that company. So that was the end of that campaign. And there's, I'm sure Sandy Rusher would give more detail.
Yeah, I'm sure
detail.
I heard from her then. I don't remember at all. And even from Chris, it's different points of that, but not in a way. And you know, this California part, which I didn't know about. We're being recorded anyway. That's enough.
So I think we've covered a lot of ground. I want to give each of you a chance to talk about anything that you feel like hasn't been covered or you want to. Any questions from you, Hannah? No? So here's what I would say. This will be archived and available, and hopefully the next generation's going to be listening in a way that we make it available. And at any rate, what would be a sum up that you would give to people who care about workers' rights in America from each of your vantage points?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, come on, this time
you're the champion of this more than anybody else in this nation.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Oh, well, name who's done more.
So say the question again. I always go along with what he wants at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that's a true statement,
it's
by the way.
It's kind of a sum up that you would give as to what one has to focus on if you're concerned about workers' rights and democracy in this country.
Yeah, well, I would say that, you know, the sum up would be it's the last version, at least as far as I know, of the CWA triangle, with movement building, you know, representation and organizing, and how they're all connected, and keeping that as if we were making a movie, and that's written down on a, you know, in the old days, a 3x5 card, and you're looking at it the entire time you're making the movie. That's what we all need to be doing.
Like I said, he nails it. It really is about trying to generate from the grassroots up. I mean, it's one individual at a time, one worker at a time. I won't even say member, just one worker at a time, trying to get them to understand, you know, that we do have power if we can pull ourselves together.